members and the like. But some of you, as you came in, may have seen some displays by the DTI entities, and I think it's a great opportunity for them to come down when committee is here and those involved in presentations. I see there's one from the NCC, the National Consumer Commission. There's one from the National Credit Regulator, and I think the National Consumer Commission was recently on TV over it would appear as they made a reappearance of the pyramid scheme. I hope nobody here thinks you can get rich that way. You're more likely to lose your house. And then there's the CG, the Companies Tribunal, and SIPC, the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission. And I would say that with fondness, because it was under my chairpersonship that we got rid of SIPO and we brought in SIPC. But obviously we're watching it heavily. And then the NCT, and that is the National, I think it is, that the Companies Tribunal. Right. And they're there as well at the moment. So on the pyramid scheme, I thought I'd take this opportunity to share with you, you're unlikely to get a recovery of your money because it's what is called illegal gains. So, you know, you're doubly wrong. You're going to rely on somebody who offers to double your money. You don't only lose the promise, but you lose what you invested. And this issue, because many years ago, CBN, when some of these schemes went west, people who had been retrenched by ISCOR found themselves with no retrenchment package and they'd lost their houses at 50 and 35 years of age. And they swelled the numbers of totally poor in the Heavy Bend district. So I really take it seriously and I want you all to communicate that to staff, friends and family. Thank you. Apologies. We have a long-standing apology, medical apology from the Honourable Mark Tush. We will make an inquiry again now about her health and hope it's not proceeding well. And who are the other apologies from Mr. Zimmons?
Chair, received an apology from Mr. Isser Zimmons on the oversight visit from another committee. We have received an apology from Mr. Adam Baldus, who will be joining the committee later today, as well as an apology from Mr. Shimamu, who is attending the party of business. Also have an apology from the State Board Advisor, who will not be attending today's proceedings. But there is a researcher, Ms. Singh, in her place if there's any questions. She won't be able to respond to any questions, but she will be able to convey those to the State Board Advisor. Thanks.
Nice to see you in my sights, as it were. will the Honourable Mayor be joining us? Because I only usually come in a bit late because of the flight.
Yes, he's on the N2, but you know, Cape Town and Rams, they don't go well together.
All right. Well, look, we've owed that name with the apologies, and I should have also indicated there was something else that you'd asked me about, Honourable Bill Lewis, and that was WTO. And I said, yes, there was an invitation so long ago, I must look it up. And in fact, it was an invitation by the minister to only two chairs, the two chairs being the NCOP chair of the system of our sister committee there, and myself. He apologises that he is not making this a group of six from Parliament, three from both halves, but financial constraints, fiscal constraints, require that he cuts back on the number of in his delegation. So it is an apology, especially as it's taking place in Africa for the first time, Kenya, at the end of the year. So my apologies, and I hope that is an indication as to what's happening. The other thing we've got then on the agenda will be the adoption of this agenda. I don't see us really going on much beyond 1:30, but we could stretch until 1:45. Right, can I have somebody to Honourable Williams, seconded by the Honourable Hilbert. And now we'll start off with a presentation by the American Chamber of Commerce and Chair. In fact, Mr. Bryan is, I regard as a little bit more than an acquaintance, seeing as we met and worked with each other more than once. It's very nice to have you here this morning. And also gives us the opportunity of sharing with you what it is we're doing, but you're also sharing your concerns with us and what you've got to say from the American businesses here and so on. So what we're going to do is to allow you free for 20 minutes or so, and perhaps a bit longer, and then an engagement. Fine, so over to yourself and anyone else you may have brought along with you. And Ms. O'Brien here, if I recall, you're the Executive Director of AmCham, is that correct? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Honourable MPs, members of the Ministry, thank you for this opportunity this morning to address you. I'm Carol O'Brien, I'm the Executive Director of the American Chamber of Commerce in South Africa, and I've come to Cape Town, it's always a pleasure to come to Cape Town, so thank you very much. I can really, really need you to love it. Firstly, I just wanted to give you a short
reminder that you need to talk into the mic. You know, everything on hand part.
Thank you. I just wanted to start with AmCham's Long and Proud Association with South Africa. If you look at the slide from 1983 to 1994, American companies were very much involved in anti-apartheid activities, and in fact, 185 American companies actually disinvested from South Africa during that time. And the strangest thing, or the nice thing about that, is that in 1994, they had all come back. Also very important to note is in 1982, the Sullivan Principles were signed by the American Chamber. In the 1980s, the American companies in South Africa were the only companies that were actually employing black people. We see that as a precursor to broad-based BEE. I just want to touch on the U.S. bequest to South Africa, just to remind everybody. In terms of PEPFAR, everybody knows what PEPFAR is. It's the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief. Oh, I'm sorry, this thing just seems to be jumping. Since 2004, the U.S. government has invested more than 4.6 billion rand in South Africa's HIV program. That was very important because we had runaway figures in terms of the AIDS. I don't want to use the word epidemic, but it was a serious situation. And the American government came to the fore and assisted us in South Africa. We also know that currently, in alignment with the South African government, more than 2.5 million people are being provided with antiretrovirals, along with the PEPFAR funding. The second bequest that is quite notable is the AGOA trade treaty. So AGOA, as you know, is currently under review. It's been in place for 15 years, and it provides duty-free access to the U.S. market. It's huge. Last year, nearly $20 billion entered the U.S. market duty-free. The idea of the U.S. government at the time was to try and grow the market in Africa, and they thought that by giving access to the American market, it would be a leg up in terms of trade with the Americas. It's been a great success. We can attribute the current success of the automobile industry to AGOA. Bear in mind that American companies don't benefit from AGOA. The trade to the U.S., they don't boost back to the U.S., so AGOA is not really for the American companies, however. And the good news is I spoke to the Honourable Member, Nikki Vihani, and she told me that the talk yesterday went very well. As you all know, we are currently in a 30-day out-of-cycle review. And for AGOA to continue, there need to be some compromises made. So I'm very happy to hear that it's a good news story from yesterday's talk. In terms of the current U.S. business contribution to South Africa, there are 600 US companies in South Africa, and we surveyed 89 of these companies in 2014. It's a small number that we actually survey because it's like asking for somebody's salary. It's very really difficult to get those figures. But if you look at those figures that are listed below that, you will see that it's a huge contribution that the American companies contributed to South Africa in just 1 year. It was 278 billion rand. They employ more than 220,000 South Africans. And it's notable that this is decent work. It's not, minimum wage doesn't come into the equation in terms of the kind of work that the American companies offer. I liked this slide when I came across it. It's a very simple slide, and really this is the competition that all companies, all countries are faced with when you're looking at investment. If you look at the little guy on the left-hand side with a question mark, he's the guy with a pen that can make, that can find all the deals. And you've got all the companies in Africa that are really the companies that are winning a lot of investment at the moment. And they're going to great degrees to win that investment. I can mention Kenya last week just passed a brand new of Kenyan offering to investors. It's called Naked Kenya. Wonderful investment package. Morocco has done something similar. Mauritius, as you know, is a tax haven. So there's great competition out there. And I really wanted to put the slide up just to show that we need to be sure that we are competitive as South Africa. My talk today is all about fair and equitable treatment. This is an international tenet of any investment. My apologies, I don't know why this is jumping. The United States has never had a bilateral investment treaty with South Africa. The feeling was that it wasn't necessary, that the BITs with the EU were something that they should profit from, so they never pushed that angle. However, the BITs have now been cancelled or taken off the table, and so this becomes an open space for the US companies. We concede that government does have the right to regulate in the public interest. Every government does do that, they have to do that, because at the end of the day it's about the country, the public coming first. However, I need to emphasize, however, fair and equitable treatment for the investors must be available. Ladies, honourable members of the House, that tenet, fair and equitable treatment, we can accept anything, but we need to know that fair and equitable treatment will be the order of the day if something like that takes place. Fair and equitable treatment, now just picked up on three of the points. Take away arbitrariness of decision making, take away abuse and coercion in decision making, and it also ensures that the denial of justice when decisions are made is done away with. So fair and equitable treatment in the case of any regulation in the public interest must be available. Now, Chairperson, I know the private security industry bill belongs to the Department of Police. I'm using this as possibly the first bill that could be utilized in terms of the protection and promotion of investment bill. I hope it's in order, Madam Chair. Clause 20 of the Private Security Industry Bill states that the South African government can take 51% of internationally owned security companies. This is in relation to clause in the bill, in the Agile Promotion and Protection Investment Bill, that says the South African government must protect the security interests of South Africa. We agree with that. South African government is the duty of the South African government to do that. So the government has now looked at the international security companies and they say, well, you've got too much information, you've got too much might in terms of the internet, in terms of security, so we want to take away the controlling interest of your companies. So obviously this will now fall under the Promotion and Protection Investment Bill. There is a procedure that is in place in terms of the bill under discussion. If there's a dispute gets declared and the minister can do certain things. Of concern is Section 8. The Republic must provide security subject to available resources and capacity. Now, that is a concern because, as I mentioned previously, you can do what you want to, but make sure that it's fair and equitable. If anything gets removed from companies, and there's a caveat in that says subject to available resources, I mean, that's a red flag for investment. So what we want to also pick up on is international security companies lose cash, then they must persuade their governments to get involved. That is problematic to us, then, actually. Now, I use the word expropriation in this sentence. I know it's a very evocative word, it's a very emotional word, and it's not mentioned in the proposal and the discussion. But, Madam Chairperson, that is the perception that is going to be created out of there. So what we're concerned about is confidence. Investment only happens in a country when people are confident that investments will be protected. So the first expropriation that, or the first time that the Protection and Promotion of Investment Bill comes into play, we're going to see a flood of investment. We believe it. We're already seeing that happening, and I have engaged with Madam Chairperson. We are under discussion to try and halt the exit of particularly the headquarters of the various American companies out of South Africa. But this statement is of the greatest of concern to us, because investment is about confidence. And if we cannot provide investors with the confidence they need to grow the investments in South Africa, then South Africa is going to be the loser. In conclusion, Madam Chairperson, investors cannot accept compensation that is fair from the bill in its current form. The fair and equitable treatment, which is a fundamental tenet of international law, is not evident, and we would plead that something gets provided in terms of the bill to cover that requirement. And then lastly, the promotion of investment is not evidenced anywhere in the bill. I recommend that the word promotion be deleted from the bill. We're waiting for policy certainty. We're currently losing jobs, the economy is stagnant. We need something to kickstart the economy, and I believe that if we can give confidence to the investment community, this will make the difference. I thank you.
Thank you very much. I do just want to come back on one or two things very quickly, Ms. O'Brien. But before I do, I just want to finish with the business as the apologies have now come in. The Honourable Colonel, who's busy playing rugby in London, you know, is a member of the parliamentary rugby team. And then the Honourable Mkongi is not feeling well today. I hope his health improves by tomorrow. So those two are away, and of course, Honourable McPherson is on his way. Just before I ask members of the committee to comment, I just want you to go over something again, Ms. O'Brien. In fact, at the time when I know you were trying to ensure I was looking at you, I was trying to clarify the PIRA, the security bill there. And I wanted to ask you, was it precisely that you're concerned with? I know you boxed here, Clause 20, and unfortunately I don't just have it with me, that's the issue, so we're just wanting to pull it up, so that we can look at the whole bill, you know, holistically, quickly. It requires 51% of international companies are transferred to South Africa, South Africans. Despite legislation that requires that management of international security companies are South Africans. And it's this anomaly, I think, as well within the bill that I just wanted to have unpacked for my health, as it is something that's been raised for the first time in this manner. that's an important point that you're making. The other thing was, I thought, before we come in as a committee, if you could just go over the point you finally make is fair and equitable treatment, okay, so which you did refer to earlier. You don't believe, the first point here in conclusion, you don't expect compensation. That is here from the bill in its current form, and that is linked to the previous line on expropriation. I'd like you to expand on that, given that we have a constitution which no doubt you would say you came in to do business and knew what the constitution was saying in South Africa, and you just come back, all of you, admittedly, in 94, and the final constitution you could have led at that point. So if you could just enable us to be on the same page as you are and just explain and clarify that a little bit more for us, because you are a major investor in our country. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I do apologize, the slides are jumping. Shall I just leave it? Thank you. The private security industry bill, Clause 20, states that 51% of internationally owned security companies must be given, they use the word given, to South Africans. This is of huge concern because we have independent legislation, other security legislation that says the management and the top people in these companies must be South Africans. This has been debated at length, Honourable Chairperson, and we haven't been able to get through to anybody in terms of that anomaly. The bill is currently on President Zuma's table for signature, and it remains as such. There is legislation in place stating that it must be controlled by South Africans, but the people in the companies are South African, so that is our argument. Why is this bill creating so much dissent?
And the fair and equitable one?
Well, the fair part of our argument is in relation to this bill, where it says that if the resources are available. Now that's of concern. What if resources aren't available? I know the Constitution does provide for that, but we like to think that legislation is well thought out and is in line with our Constitution.
Your point is made, Ms. Irvine. Thank you very much. Now, we are going to seek some clarifications from members as well. Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Williams. I thought that was a hand, Mr. Hamza, but I see it's just a bun. Right. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Brien. Your points are clearly made. I would like to just ask you what, in your view, as the representative of ACAM, would be the response from American investors and American companies if the bill was passed in its current form? What in your view, would be the response? What would be the implications for American investments in South Africa? And I suppose, consequent to that, if you could just tell us plainly, in your view, does the bill achieve or not achieve the outcome of protecting and promoting investments? You have already said that you don't think it promotes investments at all. If you could also say something about whether you believe adequately protect investments.
Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to welcome the input. I just want to ask about. You said that you believe that the South African government obviously has the right to protect, to regulate in the public interest, but now you're saying that also you don't want our private security companies to be owned and controlled by South Africans. So are you saying you, for instance, let me ask this, in America, are the private security companies owned and controlled by Americans or foreigners? Because it is security, it could potentially become a security risk to South Africa to have all the private security companies owned and controlled by foreign interests. So I'd like to know, how do you think we should address the situation so that we can secure our security in the best interest of the South African people?
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Kalaku.
Thank you, sir. Just a clarity. I understand your position. Are you implying or by implication saying that the American company they approach is that this deal is not necessary? And then if that is the view, what do you think must be done? And I'm trying to say here to avoid us getting into discussing the security deal. But as you have alluded to, companies actually, because of that deal, which is in process, and areas which they are pointing out as which do not give them certainty about their businesses here, that perception, I agree that perception will be there. But is there a way where we can be able to separate that when we persuade American investors and explain to them? Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go back to yourself, Mr. Brian.
The Honourable Chair, in response to Honourable Silver's question, what would the response of the American business community be if the bill is passed? Currently, we are struggling to keep the American companies in South Africa because most of them are not competitive. I feel they won't be competitive because they are not allowed to sell their equity. If you look at my slide, that little man with a question mark is the man who says, we will give you money to do an equity equivalent, which is the alternative to selling equity. The principals don't want to do that. They are saying it's too expensive. South Africa is but a blip on the income sheet of any global company. So this is where we at. We are really struggling. They're not going to be competitive. We are currently, and I met with the Honourable Chairperson 3 weeks ago to really plead with her. We've lost 4 companies. The headquarters have gone to Kenya, Morocco, to other places. We've seen South African companies are also starting to move out. I know 2 that have gone to Russia. So I'm a South African, and I want to see South Africa grow, and I want to see it develop. And this is of great concern to us. So if you say, what do we see? We see another nail in the coffin. We see another nail in the coffin. I would like to see this bill say, we have to do this because we have to look after the public, but we will look after our investors as well. We have to have that balance, and that is what I'm looking for. Honourable Williams, you asked if, yes, we do believe that occasionally it is necessary to regulate in the public interest. The US does not have any legislation in place that insists that private security companies have to be controlled by US people. And in fact, the US ambassador did write a letter to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee at the time of the debate, confirming that. So, I told you I'm South African. I don't see it as a problem because the management are South Africans. Why would South Africans rise up against fellow South Africans? I just don't understand it. There is legislation in place, and I'm sorry I don't have the actual name of the legislation, but I can let the Honourable Chairperson have that, and I will do that, Honourable Chairperson. That states the management has to be South African, which we see is fair. That is fair. It's South Africans running South African. It's just using the expertise of the Americans that adds to our country. Honourable Palazzo, no, I'm not implying that a bid is not necessary. I'm saying that the fact that the EU companies had bids that they could rely on were of comfort to the American companies. But this is now being removed. And that is what I'm afraid of. And that is what's causing the concern. You say, what must be done? We need a balance. We just need a balance. We just need confidence for the investors, and we will say, government, we are right behind you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. The Chief comments here that I'd make like to read. I'm going back to the private security industry, which, as you quite rightly say, is always present. And my own experience of when something lands in the presidency, they go through it with time to say, constitutionally. Mm-hmm. And the only time it's released is when more than one person is satisfied and complies with the constitution. And I know that as chairperson of the committee. But I'm looking here at that security clause. Requires 51% of international companies, that's the ownership side of it, to be transferred. The other side, management does not imply ownership. Does not imply in any way ownership. You can have 100% ownership outside the country, and yet still have about 90% South Africans there. So I think that there isn't really an anomaly here, per se. The issue is around the ownership side of it. And I think the concern that we have, and we need to get this clear, is security in a country today is really becoming a sacrosanct issue in any and every country at the moment. So, and when it comes to security companies, I'm sure that I'm not sitting in that committee, but certainly that would probably be issues they've looked at. So, you know, I think that we want to, as a committee, really unpack that for ourselves. I don't have the last word here, per se, but it is something that I don't see an anomaly on. The other issue, which is a fair one, is something different again. What do we understand by fairness? What do we understand by that? What do we understand by equitable? I mean, even an organization like the WTO grapples with that concept. What is fair? What is equitable? And I think all of us, we hear what you are saying, and we certainly appreciate it. It's extremely succinct, which a lot of countries have come here and was all around the blooming bush before they got to a point. You're being quite precise, and that's very helpful. With respect to the expropriation, you see, it is something that has not yet come out of Parliament, per se. And it reminds me of Julius Caesar. What are we writing here? Something that we fear may happen. And then you assassinate the person or clause or whatever. I think we've got to actually look at it and say, my advice to everyone is look at the Constitution. In the end, that does safeguard people. And when you look at the number that you have to have in order to change the Constitution, it's quite clear that that is a very difficult thing to undertake in this country. And I would ask you to try and review this, because I look at the amount available, 1.3 trillion. It's a lot of money for investment in our country or anywhere, and it says that particularly South Africa, and you're waiting for policy certainty. And policy certainty may be the bill as it is, but at least you know where you stand with it. So that kind of thing, we would like you yourself, if you have anything more to say, to share it with us, because this has been one of the more complex bills before the committee, and we welcome your input so far. Thank you very much. Members, we can now, you finished, aren't you, Honourable Gil Lewis? We are going to move on to the next one, and as we're doing that, I'd like to welcome the DG of ETI, Sir Lionel October, the DDD, and that is Ms. Toilelwa Tombi Peter, Dr. Mustakeem Degama, Ms. Nikki Kruger, and Mr. Stephen Matate. I must just say that we have engaged with you before, Mr. Degama, and that was during the workshop, am I correct? And thank you very much for being here during that particular time. So we're going to go on to the next one now, which will be Anglo-American, but Mr. Azima, CEO of Kumba. We actually went to Kumba last term, and we're very impressed with your training establishment there, I must say, in Kumba. Mr. Sumbu, Executive Head of Anglo-American South Africa, Mr. Lester, Anglo-American Head of Group Legal South Africa. Just indicate who you are. Yes. Ms. Bohani, Anglo-American Legal Advisor. Not here today, right?
That's me, I'm here.
Okay.
My name is Andy Sangu.
Oh, I see, someone got it wrong here. Yes, we must get these things right. Mr. Peter Leon, Weber and Henschel. That's where somewhere he's just popped up. And Mr. Winks. All right. So it's just a mistake here. It's Andy Sangu. Right. Executive Head of Anglo-American. But Miss Bawani, okay, thank you. Right, now, you're going to come in here now, thank you very much. And I'm sure you can see how it's been done, and we'll give you 20 minutes as well. Thank you for coming here today.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and good morning to everyone. I'm here with my colleagues. My name is Andy Lashano. I'm the Executive Head of Anglo-American in South Africa. I'm here on my left with my colleague, Kevin Lester, who is the head of group legal services in Anglo-American, with one of our colleagues as well, Tommy on my right. And this will be a joint presentation between myself and Kevin. Just to start off, I mean, Anglo-American South Africa Limited welcomes the opportunity to make its submission in relation to the Promotion and Protection of Investment Bill 2015. We believe that this submission will contribute positively to the process of enacting legislation which will enhance the attractiveness of South Africa as an investment destination. Our primary concerns with the bill are as follows. The bill, as it is currently drafted, may create a reduced appetite for foreign investors to make long-term commitments into South Africa. South Africa's competitiveness as a favorable investment destination compared to our regional neighbors will be diminished. Foreign investors, by virtue of being non-citizens of South Africa, do not enjoy the same privileges as that of South African citizens. Therefore, any uncertainty in the protection standards, such as the ability to seek recourse from international tribunal, guaranteed market-related compensation for any of expropriation, and assured fair and equitable treatment, may deter them from viewing South Africa as an investment destination. We hope that these submissions will provide the Portfolio Committee with recommendations which, if considered, could contribute positively to South Africa becoming the most favorable destination for foreign direct investment, not only in the SADC region, but in Africa at large. I now turn to address you on Anglo-American South Africa and briefly outline its views on the Promotion and Protection of Investment Bill. Anglo-American is a diversified global mining company which was established in 1917 in South Africa. We are intrinsically a South African company. However, we have foreign investors who contribute generously to our sustainability. While Anglo-American PLC operates in numerous geographies in the world, the operations in South Africa still present a material and a strategic portion of Anglo-American. For that reason, Anglo-American remains sincerely committed to working together with the South African government to find solutions to improve the economy. Currently, South Africa sits at 56th in the World Economic Forum's Competitive Index. There is a need to improve this position and improve South Africa's competitiveness as an investment destination. Mining in South Africa directly contributed to the establishment of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange in the late 19th century, and today it still accounts for a third of its market capitalization. It is clear how much mining in South Africa has shaped the country's politically, the country both politically, culturally, and economically. Mining contributes about 18% of South Africa's GDP in direct and in indirect terms. This can be aggregated broadly as 60% of exports, 500,000 direct jobs, and 800,000 indirect jobs. Through taxes and other benefits, mining contributes to about 10 cents in every rand that is invested in public infrastructure and social benefits within South Africa. As you are all aware, the South African mining industry has been underperforming compared to its global peers. And this is the result of the declining commodity prices, uncertain regulatory framework, unfriendly investment policies, and labor unrest. Despite the struggling mining industry, Anglo American's contribution to South Africa is a deep and a meaningful one. To ensure a lasting positive legacy, we supplement the value generated through our core activities with initiatives designed to develop host communities in the long term, including investment in health facilities, jobs, skills, and infrastructure. Over the last 5 years, our business expended a cumulative amount of 3.2 billion rand on local capacity development, infrastructure for healthcare, education, housing, and sanitation, and other areas. Over the last 5 years, our business units have spent more than 5 billion rand on improving the housing and living conditions of our employees. Between 2010 and 2014, our businesses collectively spent more than 3.5 billion rand on SDSA training and development. Over the past 4 years, our South African business units have spent more than 100 billion rand with BE suppliers. Foreign direct investment is a mechanism through which Anglo-American can meet its social responsibility and contribute towards the transformation and socio-economic imperatives of South Africa. Social challenges can seldom be addressed by individual action alone. Unlocking the value of South Africa's minerals for sustainable development requires partnership and accountability at every turn. Our engagements with government and the rest of the industry have been consistent and will continue to be well received. We are committed to building relationships across every stakeholder group in pursuing our growing developmental contribution. And as citizens of this country, a partner of the South African government, we would like to make these submissions and bring to your attention any unintended long-term negative consequences that this proposed bill may create. Anglo-American supports the South African government in its initiatives to place mechanisms in place for the governance of investments. However, such invites should not fundamentally deviate from the international trends, thus resulting in non-alignment with the principles which underpin the Charter Protocol and the practice of the BRICS member states. With respect to Anglo-American, Anglo-American is concerned that the bill as drafted may further impair the current economic situation and investor confidence in not only mining, but also in other sectors which rely heavily on foreign investors. I'm going to ask my colleague, Kevin Lester, to give more background to the bill. Thank you very much.
Good morning. It falls to me to do the difficult work of trying to make sense of all of these various pieces of the bill and various policies in place, and I hope to take you through it as easily as possible. After South Africa became a democratic state in 1994, concluded a number of bilateral investment treaties with the United States in order to attract much needed foreign direct investment to stimulate growth and development. The first of these, one of the first of these, was with the United Kingdom, which is the source of much of the foreign investment into Anglo-American PLC. Bits of binding international agreements in which two states out of mutual respect for one another's equal sovereignty make a formal commitment to treat investments from one another's nationals in accordance with certain standards which typically include but are not limited to fair and equitable treatment, meaning that the government must maintain a reasonably reliable, predictable and transparent regulatory environment, market value compensation for expropriation, including indirect expropriation, meaning measures which affect, effectively protect the value of investments, and investor state dispute settlement, which permits individual foreign investors to refer disputes with host governments directly to international arbitration. The other areas which are covered are national treatment, most favored nations, treatment, a free transfer of funds, and full protection of security. South Africa took significant steps to modernize its investment protection regime by signing and ratifying the SADC Protocol on Finance and Investment in 2006, which obliges all members of SADC, including South Africa, to give good standards of protection to foreign investors from any country in the world and to submit international enforcement of those standards by investor state arbitration after domestic remedies have been exhausted. The SADC Protocol was intended to be the foundation for the coordinated liberalisation and harmonisation of the region's investment regimes, which was rightly regarded as essential to attract long-term FDI. South Africa's Parliament ratified the protocol in 2008 and it came into force in 2010. The SADC protocol includes most of the typical standards of protection, which standards of protection establish foreign investor confidence. South Africa contributed to the development of SADC Model FIT, which aims to harmonize investment policies in accordance with the SADC Protocol and to assist SADC states in negotiating more balanced FITs. In 2008, the DTI initiated a review of the country's FITs, which was completed in June 2009, recommending that South Africa should renegotiate its FITs. By 2012, some 4 years later, South Africa had helped develop the SADC Model template, which addressed any concerns identified during the review of our BITS as a result of that 2008 review. In July 2010, Cabinet adopted the recommendations with regard to the review of our BITS as the basis upon which BITS could be evaluated and renegotiated. By June 2012, the SADC Model BITS had been completed. However, from September 2012, shortly after the SADC Model BITS had been settled, rather than renegotiating its BITS in accordance with the SADC Model BITS and following its participation in developing the SADC Protocol, South Africa commenced with the termination of its existing BITS, primarily with its European Union trading partners. The unilateral termination and non-renewal of BITS of the European Union trading partners sent a negative message to the South African and EU business community at large, particularly because of the lack of transparency in which we attended to unilateral terminations and non-renewals. The EU Chamber of Commerce and Industry in South Africa highlighted this fact vividly last week before the committee, noting that some of their members are actively negotiating other African destinations such as Namibia, Nigeria, and Kenya for their regional African operations. The current bill promotes discomfort leading to discouragement relating to new investments. Anglo-Americans concerned that such action has the potential of undermining South Africa's credibility as a business partner to the international community and could discourage global business in placing any solid reliance on the commitments made by government to encourage public sector investment and engage business in promoting inclusive growth. While the bill does aim to establish technical equality between foreign and local investments, it also overlooks the fact that domestic law, by its very design, differentiates between citizens and foreigners. In this regard, there is a critical feature of all national constitutions. Citizens bear certain political, economic, and social rights, which by definition do not extend to non-citizens, the foreign investors inclusive. Respectfully, would like to encourage the DTI to consider remodeling the bill in such a way that it demonstrates South Africa's commitment to negotiate new binding international agreements in place of terminated BITS in accordance with the SADC Protocol, the SADC Model BITS, as well as the SADC Investment Policy Framework, which is to be released, I believe, in November 2015. And in November 2015, the DTI published a draft of a bill for public comment stating, "The bill is a significant milestone in the process to update and modernize South Africa's legal framework to protect investors in South Africa. The bill clarifies standards of protection for investors, both foreign and domestic, by setting out provisions ordinarily found in BITS in a manner that is consistent with South Africa's constitution and existing legal framework. The bill, however,
does not necessarily achieve these objectives because it is inconsistent with the standards required by SADC protocol, the practices of other BRICS members, and UNCTAD's framework for reforming international investment law. Far from modernizing South Africa's legal framework for investment protection, it makes it intrinsically incompatible with modern international investment law, including the SADC protocol, which is still premised on the establishment and enforcement of investment standards at the international level. And rather than clarifying the standards of protection ordinarily funding BRICS, the bill only obscures and includes them, and is thus inconsistent with several specific provisions of the SADC protocol itself and with the SADC model. It is recommended by Anglo American that the bill should seek to align itself with the protections and assurances contained in the BRICS, such as fair and equitable treatment, market value compensation for expropriation, and investor state dispute settlement. I would now like to turn my attention to the relationship between the bill and the SADC international investment standards. The second purpose of the SADC protocol on finance and investments is to foster harmonization of the financial investment policies of state parties in order to make them consistent with the objectives of SADC and ensure that any changes to the financial and investment policies in the state partner party do not necessitate undesirable adjustments to other state parties. Stated purpose is to be achieved by facilitation of regional integration, cooperation and coordination within the finance and investment sectors. The Africa's obligations under the protocol include to create favorable conditions to attract investment, to ensure proper compensation for expropriation or nationalization, and to afford foreign investors fair and equitable treatment. The SADC protocol is binding on South Africa both internationally and constitutionally. It promises protection to foreign investors from any state of the world, not only from SADC states. It is consistent with modern international investment law, and the SADC protocol internationalizes the relationship between the host state and its foreign investors and creates investor rights that are fixed at the international level, which is central to a regime of protection of foreign direct investment. The bill is drafted offers no special protection for foreign investors. Madam Chair, I need to return to a comment made by Ndile earlier on, where he made specific reference to the fact that the Constitution does not grant the same level of protection to foreign investors who are non-citizens as it would to citizens. The bill is drafted that as such provides no special protections. This is fundamentally at odds with the SADC Protocol, which is an international treaty which South Africa has signed and ratified, as well as the SADC model. SADC model bit, which presupposes investment, existence and enhancement of international treaties regulating investment protection. The bill is thus asked for South Africa's obligations on the SADC protocol to harmonize its investment law with that of other SADC states, as well as the objective of SADC as a whole. Anglo-American does, however, recognize that positive strides contained and emphasized in the law, such as the obligations imposed on foreign investors to align themselves with the socio-economic transformation imperatives of South Africa. We commend this as a progressive stance. SADC has cooperated with OECD to develop a regional investment policy framework. The aim of this process, which takes place against a global backdrop, is regional policy harmonization and peer learning. Globally, there is a move towards harmonized investment policies and a substantial increase in international investment agreements, including regional agreements. Although the SADC protocol in investment was adopted in 2006, the region's policies are far from harmonized. To complicate matters further, South Africa's decision to terminate its BRICS many of its traditional investment partners flies in the face of SADC crisis and has given rise to investor uncertainty. The current global investment climate and investment agreement environment provides SADC with a unique opportunity to set the stage for harnessing FDI into future growth and development. Where possible, once the SADC policy framework for investment is released, the bill should be reviewed against it to ensure an alignment on the key principles. The following two slides in the presentation serve as a case study on how another member of the SADC, namely Mauritius, has used the SADC approach to consider the advantage. I do not wish to dwell on this, other than to observe that Mauritius has replaced South Africa as the highest ranked and safe international investment destination. Now I'd like to turn my focus onto the BRICS practices around foreign direct investment. The BRICS economies comprise the major emerging markets. South Africa was formally invited to join BRICS in December 2010. Notwithstanding that when compared to the other BRICS nations, South Africa is by far the smallest in economic output, It has an important role as it is a representative of the African continent in BRICS. BRICS believes that foreign direct investment can make a positive contribution to sustainable development and integrated international development strategies. BRICS has recognized that through FDI, member states can get the benefit of technology transfer, skills development, and the establishment of stronger supply chains between domestic and foreign firms. Within BRICS, the trend appears towards greater investment protection at international level. The table on this slide demonstrates the commitment of our BRICS partners to international investment agreements. Even Brazil is starting to conclude international investment agreements. Brazil does not have any BRICS, but has traditionally relied on other factors to attract foreign direct investment inflows. However, recognizing that international investment agreements are essential to secure its own outward investments, Brazil has developed a model cooperation facilitation investment agreement, which has been implemented in 2015 by signings of Mozambique, Angola, Mexico, and Malawi. China has recently concluded one of the world's most recent international trade agreements with Australia, a country that competes directly with South Africa in supply of iron ore to China. This is also contrary to suggestions that a country like Australia are moving away from this. This slide makes it some interesting reading. Between 2019, our BRICS partners have been particularly busy concluding various international investment agreements to promote trade and investment. China now has the second largest number of BRICS of all countries in the world. In the corresponding period, South Africa has terminated all but a handful of international investment agreements. Finally, turning our attention to the UNCTAD framework. The DTI has stated that the termination of BRICS and the deinternationalization of investment protection is consistent with international trade. However, UNCTAD notes in the World Investment Report 2015 that while many countries are engaged in investment policy reform, and I quote, by far a smaller group have announced a moratorium on future international investment negotiations, while some others have chosen a more radical approach by starting to terminate existing international investment agreements, close quote. There is some difficulty in reconciling the DTI view with UNCTAD and believes that we can all benefit from a greater understanding as to the reasons for this apparent misalignment. We have demonstrated that the bill runs contrary to the SADC protocol and the approach adopted by BRICS partners. UNCTAD suggests that South Africa belongs to a group which includes Indonesia, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Venezuela, who are moving in a very different direction to the rest of the world. Now, for the final slide, I'll hand over to my colleague, Andy.
In conclusion, Anglo-American South Africa believes that the investment into our economy should be aligned to that of our region and our BRICS partners. We remain committed to supporting the South African government in its quest to reform investment governance that offers reasonable protection and assurances to all investors. An investment reform that would promote and encourage foreign direct investment in an effort to redirect the attention of South Africa as the investment destination of choice. Investment policies in South Africa need to support sustainability and aim to achieve a more inclusive growth path for private investors. Investment can help to sustain economic development. However, this requires policies that are aligned with that of our regional and our major international partners. In conclusion, in this modern global economy, going it alone and developing an investment regime which is at odds with international trends seem to be a gamble, the consequences of which could be felt for generations to come. Notwithstanding that the consequences of existing investments will not be immediate. Therefore, Anglo-American implores the South African government to strongly reconsider the proposed bill in an effort to retain the current FDI and create a regulatory environment which will encourage further FDIs. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you very much, Mr. Sumlu, Executive Head of Anglo-American South Africa. I wonder if you would just go back, you just start off with the presentation, thank you, to your page 5, where you give us a broad overview of Anglo-Americans' role in the economy, etc. And I noticed there that, you know, with respect to the number of people employed in South Africa, the figures are for 2013. You don't have the 2014 figures as you do with the strategic assets, which are noted below, which are reflected to be in 2014. If you needed to consult someone, you can come back a little bit later this morning. But that is very, very constructive, as we could get that. The other breakdown, given that this is regarded as an overview, as you know, when you look at the period 2010 and so on, you're looking at a couple of years just within that first recessionary period itself, and then you're looking at 2014. What was the figure in 2009, and what was the figure in 2010? You know, can we have something comparison here? It's very difficult to say this is good, bad, or where we stand if we don't have a comparison to reflect upon. And, of course, the same, sorry, my eyes are even with space, amount of capex invested since 1999. Well, the fact of the matter is we just had the fat years, if you want to put it that way, and then we had the lean. So, again, what's the comparative figure to look at? Thank you so much on that one. And the other one probably relates to your colleague, where there seem to be, I don't know who handled slide 9, still on background, referred to as the termination of it. If you would clarify this, because the news and information I have is that we simply didn't renew them, which is somewhat different to termination. And when you don't renew something, the actual clauses of protection, etc., of your investment remain in place. And I remember raising this at the time 3 or 4 years ago. What is the situation? And we were reassured by the minister that the protection would remain in force for, I think, 10 years or more. So if you would clarify which ones were terminated, because I'm not aware that any were terminated, I'm aware that some were not renewed. Thank you. And now let me go across to our colleagues here, the Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Williams. Can we make a start with that?
Mr. Sankul and Mr. Lester, I appreciate that you sent a very senior delegation to come and make this presentation today. That's unusual for companies that come and present to us, but it's greatly appreciated. Your presentation is very sobering, and Anglo American is obviously a massive investor in the South African economy, and as you quite rightly pointed out, even though it is a South African company, it relies greatly on international capital markets to sustain its investment. I want to ask a very simple question. If you could tell us what you believe the impact on Anglo-American investment in South Africa would be if this bill was passed in its current form. Simple question. And then the second question, if I may, Chairperson, pose a question to the departmental representatives. The presentation raises a very interesting point as to whether this bill has been aligned with our SADC commitments in terms of investments policy and the SADC protocol of investment, and whether it has been aligned and harmonized with our BRICS partners as is required. And I'd really like to know whether that has been done or not. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've just got one thing I'd just like to mention or talk to. You talked a lot about investment uncertainty with this new legislation, but now I've been in politics for many years now, and every time the ANC does anything which puts the people of South Africa first and white business second, there's business uncertainty. I think that the investor uncertainty is more like investor paranoia, and nothing has happened. We have a constitution that protects you, and the bill does provide for that, and I think that what you're saying is that our constitution is not enough. Is that the case? Is that what you're saying? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Looking at members again, Honourable Kalaku, Honourable McPherson.
Just one question following from me. You say that the bill, I think that you are not the only one who allude to this point. Other presenters did mention the department, I'm sure he is going to. You say this the department took a unilateral decision just not to to cancel this bid. So all in all, you said you were not consulted when the whole process was starting on formulating this bid up to the stage where it is here with us. That's one clarity I need. The other one, you are saying a bill actually goes against the trend internationally. Well, you are saying the trend internationally, these countries, even our friendly countries where we do trade with them or partners, the trend to society is to enter into this business. Whereas here you are saying what is implied by the bid is to move away from that, which makes a business uncomfortable. So if you can just clarify those points for me.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kalaka. Honorable McPherson.
Thanks, Jim. I apologize, I'm a bit late, but there was a terrible accident on the M2, which, coupled with when there's a bit of rain on the roads, okay, so I'm keen to become a bit unsettled. But with respect to the investment bill, when one couples it with proposed legislation like the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Amendment Bill, the Expropriation Bill, and those are also bills in red with this could be potentially devastating to a business like Anglo American. So what is your holistic view? Because I get the sense that you guys keep wanting to just focus on this bill when in fact there are many other bills when read with it become problematic for investment and business security. Because if there's one thing that certainly a business like yours in unstable times like this requires the ability to look forward into what government's legislative program is and whether that determines your investments going forward. And so I would like to get your view on a holistic picture of legislation feeding into this particular bill and how that affects your business. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable McPherson. And over to yourself, any order, Mr. Trump.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and thank you to members for those questions. Our approach to these questions is that we're going to split them into two. My colleague Kevin would respond to some of the more legal technical questions, and I'll try and respond to the other questions. So if I may begin, just to start off to say to you, Madam Chair, that the information that you have requested in relation to the competitors, we would indeed assure to that request, it will be compiled, and it will be forwarded to you.
Thank you very much, I appreciate that.
Yeah. I then want to deal with the issue of investor uncertainty and the comments that was made by the honourable member that each time that the bills are being proposed and there is a sentiment that these bills necessarily result in investor uncertainty. We don't subscribe to that view. I mean, the reason why we're here today is because we are encouraged by the spirit of consultation and engagement and working together to try and improve your certainty. I think that the reason why we're here, we believe that in arriving at an investment climate, it would be undergirded by the spirit of business and government working together to create that environment and that planet. And this is something that we as Anglo-Americans support and encourage how it is playing itself out. On the point that Mr. McPherson is raising, I think it's a very important point, and we would like to urge that this matter be considered quite seriously in the sense that some of these pieces of legislation, from where we sit, you know, we would obviously have to take an integrated and a holistic approach. In other words, the part of creating the picture that is necessary and relevant for us to appraise in its totality the investment environment in South Africa. And therefore, some of these pieces of legislation tend to have the effect of contradicting with one another, or at best, creating an environment where it has become so burdensome for us to implement and quite costly. So we'd ask that in the spirit of cooperation and collaboration, let's find a different mechanism of the different government departments dealing with the same industry, finding a way of a far more coordinated approach, because we think that in itself would have been improving, you know, the kind of investment plans that we would want. It would also make it far easier for investors to understand, you know, the whole economic picture for investment in South Africa. I'd like to ask my colleague Kevin to deal with the rest of the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Honourable Member Lewis asked me, simple question is, what would the impact be of this bill become law? I think ultimately that the best way in which to answer that question is to say that when you approach any person with a view to seeking investment of any nature, they're going to naturally look at the circumstances surrounding the investment and whether that investment is secure. With each change and with each level of uncertainty which comes into South Africa's international investment regime, what we do is we essentially make ourselves potentially less attractive. For Anglo-American, what that means is greater difficulty in being able to source that investment internationally. You have to bear in mind that for a company like ours, a very substantial portion of our market capitalization is assets which are based in South Africa. So if there is an exception, those assets cannot be fully secured. That necessarily is going to make our life somewhat more difficult. Madam Chair, you raised the issue with regard to termination and non-renewal. Look, I think it's probably appropriate for me to say that we submitted the presentation during the course of last week, and when we reviewed it in the speaker's notes, you will have noted that I made a change there from termination to termination and non-renewal. Having said that, Madam Chair, I do think it is important to note that the effect is the same. And whilst it may be the contention that these non-renewals are subject to a sunset provision, we need to understand that the sunset provision only protects investments which were in place on the date of non-renewal. So the fact that there is 20 years of protection does nothing in respect of any investments or capital projects that will be commenced now. It merely caters for those which were in existence on the date that there was a non-renewal. Honourable Kulaka asked a question as to whether we were consulted and asked me to speak to the issue of going against the trend. Honourable Kulaka, I think it's probably appropriate for me to say that our company, as being a company which has gone to London specifically with a view to raise foreign investment, at no stage were consulted on how this message should be communicated to foreign investors and how it should be presented, which obviously would have been helpful to us if we were able to do so. We are aware that the DGI made an announcement some time ago that they were planning to review these, but as these bits were not as the process of non-renewal of these bits was underway, there was absolutely no discernible consultation with regard to that. There certainly was very much media attention to it. And whilst it didn't take us by surprise, we were somewhat concerned to discover that the UK bit, it obviously affects many of our investors, had been not renewed without us even noticing. So that is a concern for us. But having said that, I think the important principle of that is that we've demonstrated in our presentation that this is in fact going against the trend internationally. Many other countries are going the route of reviewing but reinforcing their international investment agreements. Whereas it's a very small group of companies, the countries of South Africa appears to be aligning with, which seems to be going in a very different direction. So final point on that, I don't want to hog the floor, Honourable Kulaka, but if I could just, as a final point, in relation to that, make the point that the BTI's original announcement was that it intended to review the bilateral investment treaties. It was not a statement which said we intend to review and if necessary not renew, or we intend to review and if not necessary terminate. It was simply we wish to review. And in my presentation I pointed out that concurrently with that process of the review, the South African government was engaged in the process of SADC, where they were in fact developing a model that, now, it may well be that the DTI's view is that we will not renew these bits, but in due course we will replace them with new bits in compliance with the SADC model, the SADC protocol. So that we don't know. That hasn't been discussed.
I just wanted to request one more thing in the absence of further questions or comments from the members of the committee, and that is what we have asked for, certainly during the engagement, we may not have requested it prior to this, what would be extremely welcome but also constructive for us would be, what proposals do you have? You've seen the bill, it may be short, but it's complex. And it does require us to read it alongside other bills or legislation already enacted, but also the Constitution. And it was for that purpose that we also requested that the State Law Advisor provide us with advice, which was available to those presenters who came the other day, of course. And that made a specific reference to the two clauses you read, not the termination one, or the renewal, as we would say, but that dealing with fair and equitable, and that dealing with expropriation. And I think one should be mindful of the fact that even given the application of the current expropriation bill, just to read an extract from this, which you would find here, and then simply say that despite the provisions of any law to the contrary, that includes our own, any expropriating authority may not expropriate property arbitrarily or for a purpose other than for a public purpose or in the public interest. And then furthermore, this should be exercised, not be exercised unless the expropriating authority has without success attempted to reach an agreement. So it requires, there's an obligation to negotiate. You can't simply expropriate. And I think it's quite informative from the State Law Advisor with respect to some of the clauses that have been referred to so far. So if you would like a copy, you're welcome to have it. Now, around you, know, yourself, Mr. Medema, you're trying in the way there, and you could come to where I can see you. I mean, you know, I have to actually turn my entire body. Please, get a couple more copies of this, all right? Thank you. So just on that one, it would be welcome proposals. Right, European is a country, a company, a huge company since 1917. There have been huge investments here. We obviously don't want to lose them. But you're not helping us, other than saying we don't be because of that. Help us to review this piece of legislation effectively, as you are oversight. Thank you very much. Right, now can we move on to the next grouping that we have? Sorry, Honourable Hillers, did you have your hand up?
Chair, I put the question to the department.
You did. I don't normally do this, but the question is highly pertinent just in this instance. Can you please just come in there, DDG?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Good morning to honourable members and everyone in the room. In terms of the SADC Financing Investment Protocol, it has been reviewed in line with the global trends, and some of the provisions that are problematic have been removed in the new reviewed Financing Investment Protocol. So what has been done to align the SADC Financing Investment Protocol in terms of Annex 1 to the investment deal. the new ship in terms of Annex 1 is expected to be adopted by Minister of Finance before the end of the year, and then we'll go to Council and Fund for approval and adoption. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Of course, you appreciate, Honourable Hill Lewis, the department will be coming again for further engagement and to dig deeper on the matter. But I would really like to thank American Pretending, their two top representatives in the country. It indicates to Parliament that you're taking the process very seriously. Thank you. And then we'll move on to the South African Institute for Race Relations. And from the South African Institute, we've got Mrs. R. Ward Adams, senior researcher, is that correct? Civil and political rights. Is that right? Yes. Thank you. If you would take your seat there and just come in. After this presentation, there'll be a very short, I imagine, tea break at about 11:15, just 5 minutes or so, maybe 10, and then we'll move on to Barsha after tea. All right, are we all ready? Yes. So straight over to yourself, the South African Institute of Race Relations.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, Members of Parliament, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address the Fifth Committee this morning on the Promotion and Protection of Investment Bill. I'm here on behalf of the South African Institute of Race Relations, the IRR, which was formed in 1929 to oppose racial discrimination, promote racial goodwill, and non-racial democracy.
I'm sorry, but I've given the wrong name, and as you and I haven't met, I just assumed you were the person who was elected here. So we have, and I'm looking at a woman here, not a Mr. Miss Anthea Jeffries. It isn't Anthea Jeffries, it's Dr. Anthony Jeffries. There we are. Doctoral, please go ahead.
Thank you. I just want to sketch some of the problems with the investment bill. First of all, the definition of investment is too limited. It would exclude shares, for example. It would exclude intellectual property. And I would advocate that we have a wider definition and so that it's described in due course. There is, in fact, no guarantee that foreign investors will have equal treatment with domestic ones. Instead, this will depend, firstly, on national legislation. Both laws which are already on the statute book and any legislation which might be adopted in the future. So there's great uncertainty as to what that heralds. There's also the fact that foreign investors will have to show like circumstances with domestic ones. The definition of like circumstances is very complicated and very vague. It has broad and uncertain criteria which are hard to interpret, hard to know how they will be applied in any given case. In addition, it's very important that the bill states that the level of security to be provided to foreign investors will depend on the state's available resources and capacity. So in a context where revenue is down, debt is rising, and growth is rather anemic, there's a real concern that the state's resources might be too limited to pay adequate compensation. As for the measure of compensation, nothing specifically is said, but the reference to Section 25 in the Bill of Rights presumably means that on expropriation a foreign investor would be entitled to market value minus the four discount factors listed in Section 25, which include things like the history of the acquisition of the property and the purpose of the expropriation. These factors are very difficult to quantify in monetary terms, so again, it's hard to predict just how much might be taken off, as it were, in terms of the discount factors. I think there is a concern among foreign investors that the discount could be as much as 40%. And then there's also the possibility of a deduction from that amount based on the state's available resources. as regards the repatriation of the capital invested here from abroad and the returns on its profits, capital gains and the like, that will be entirely dependent on applicable legislation, both present and future, again, causing great uncertainty. There will be limited access to international arbitration, which will depend, first of all, on the state agreeing the case of dispute, and thereafter giving its consent to international arbitration. But international arbitration will only be available once domestic remedies have been exhausted, and only on a state-to-state basis between our government and the government of the affected investor, whereas most investors must be able to participate directly in any dispute proceedings. There's also no promise of fair and equitable treatment, which is a standard provision in bilateral investment treaties, including the one that we still have for the Republic of China. But the fair and equitable treatment clause, though it seems to be controversial, is rarely simply in line with the Constitution, because what the clause requires is that the state should enact laws that are transparent, reasonable, and certain. And that's also what our Constitution requires. The Constitution recognizes the supremacy of the rule of law as one of its founding values, along with the importance of accountability and openness. And the rule of law, of course, requires certainty and predictability in legislation. So the two concepts are really very much the same. There's also the practical aspect. In practice, there seems to be little hope of effective redress for those who were disadvantaged in the past through laws that don't adequately meet these criteria, that aren't, for example, sufficiently certain. And we can see that in the provisions of the MPRDA, the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act of 2002, that came to effect in 2004. Many of its provisions in both the mining charter are so vague that investors find it difficult to know exactly how the rules would be applied, and the rules do seem to have been applied in a differential way on different occasions. And this has become a major problem for investment in mining in South Africa. We've plummeted down the Fraser Institute index of the attractiveness of different countries to international investors. And we can see the difference just next door in Botswana, which has clear and certain mining legislation and has gone up the index even as we have fallen down it. But where our mining sector is in particular trouble, Botswana has been able to fare significantly better. Then we have a great emphasis on the bill on the state's regulatory powers and the concerns that this will encourage more vague and unpredictable laws, which might be intended to help provide the grace, but that will not be effective in doing so, and that will also consist with the Constitution's requirement for adherence to the rule of law, for accountability and transparency. In a jurisdiction, it's not enough to give foreign or domestic investors the right to property in terms of Section 25 of the Constitution, as the bill does, when Section 25 is in fact being undermined or possibly even breached by the Expropriation Bill of 2015, which at the moment will, after a process of bill negotiations, allow an expropriation authority simply to issue, serve a notice of expropriation. And if that notice were to be served on, say, the 1st of November, then ownership of the property could pass to the state on 2nd of November. The only limitation in the bill is that a count was passed before that the notice is served. And possession of the property could also pass automatically to the state very soon thereafter, whereas the payment of compensation can be delayed. And people may have no right to assess the validity of the expropriation before the court, but in practice, even if the law allows them to do that, people who have already lost ownership and possession of what might have been their key asset will not be in a position to approach the court to contest either the validity of the expropriation or whether the compensation is truly just and equitable. And on the compensation point, they will have only 60 days to do so, failing which they will be deemed to have accepted whatever the state offers. So these principles undermine the protection in Section 25. The Private Security Industry Regulation Amendment Bill has previously been mentioned in requiring that private security companies should transfer 51% of their assets or equity to South Africans. It effectively paves the way for an indirect expropriation, where the state does not acquire ownership, but the owner no longer has full ownership rights or the benefits of ownership. And that too is something which may not be compensated by the appropriation law and undermines the protection of Section 85. Then we have 51% EEE ownership requirements, either rather informally, when ESCOM says it will only deal with coal suppliers that have 51% EEE ownership, rather than the 26% in the NPRDA, or in a new EEE generic code, under which many smaller firms in particular are coming under pressure to transfer 51% of their ownership to EEE investors at often very steep discounts in order to keep doing business at all. Then the NPRDA amendments, as we mentioned here before, they could still give the mining minister the power to set prices and allow or disallow exports over both designated and strategic minerals, which again is like of an indirect expropriation limiting the rights of the owner. And there are various land measures which also undermine property rights and which unfortunately are not really compensation for past discrimination because they are attempting to empower the state and give the state ownership, control or custodianship of land, whereas those previously debarred from ownership will be confined simply to having leases of such land. In terms of what necessary changes should be made to the bill, I would urge the expanded definition of investment to cover every kind of asset, as in the Chinese Bilateral Investment Treaty, including shares and intellectual property rights. That we should make it clear that there can be no direct or indirect appropriation in a case where a dispute arises, unless the court has confirmed in advance that the expropriation is valid and that the amount of compensation is truly just and equitable. And it could only be valid, of course, if it's not irrational and if it is truly either in the public interest as defined in the Constitution or for public purposes. As regards compensation, this must, I think, in terms of Section 25, be based on market value based on discount factors. But it should also include damages for all direct losses resulting from expropriation, which is in our current Expropriation Act and is in no way barred by the wording of Section 25, and would strike a more equitable balance between the public interest and the interest of the affected owner. Also, in terms of necessary changes, I think we should guarantee to all investors fair and equitable treatment, which is what the Constitution requires, and which is also the best way to provide redress through clear and certain laws, which will truly open up opportunities for the disadvantaged, rather than, as in the case of the mining sector, see a steady diminution in jobs. We should also give international investors the right to international arbitration, which is the international norm, and we should guarantee the repatriation of the capital that has been invested here and the returns on it. Above all, we must both pledge and provide a sound investment climate, which must be gauged in terms of this bill, but also in terms of the wider policy environment. Other small changes, we should remove vague provisions on life treatment, and certainly also the reference to the state's available resources and capacity. And it's important, where the state has in the public interest, that this should be defined in the way that Section 25 of the Constitution says. In other words, in order to promote land reform and a more equitable allocation of natural resources. The debate option would be to withdraw the bill altogether and redraft it, because the current draft is too vague to be constitutional. As I said, the rule of law requires clear, certain, predictable rules, and this bill does not meet that criterion. In addition, I have concerns, and I'm sure other people do too, that the time allowed for public consultation has been too short, and in itself can be a barrier to the constitutionality of the measure. Parliament, of course, has an obligation to enact legislation which is constitutional. It also has a duty to all the people of South Africa to look at what the likely impact of legislation is going to be on growth and jobs. We need, I think, to recognize that redistribution is not enough to meet the needs of the growing population, that the cake can't simply be redivided differently. We must grow the cake. And population has gone up from 40 million in 1995 to 54 million in 2014, which is quite a significant increase. And it's now growing at almost a million a year. And all these new South Africans also need to have opportunities. Despite the many more jobs that have been created since 1994, the number of people who are unemployed on the expanded definition which means they want jobs, but they're not no longer able to keep looking for them, perhaps because they have no money for the church. That number has gone up for from 3.7 million in 1994 to 8.4 million in 2015, which is more than a doubling. For jobs, we need to have growth at the rate of 5% to 7% of GDP, as Joel Marcus of the Reserve Bank recently stressed. 70% at 7% of GDP, you double your economy every 10 years, and there will be endlessly more opportunities. But our average growth rate has been 1.8% of GDP since 2009. It's very far below the level that we need. Growth is absolutely vital, and it fell even further in 2014. It came at 1.5% of GDP. It's zero so far this year. If we look at the growth rate per person, also very important, not only the growth rate of the country as a whole, but the growth rate in relation to each individual South African, it was 0.1% of GDP in 2014, down from 1.1% in 1994, which was worryingly low even then. And GDP per person has shrunk in the past. In fact, it took us 25 years until 2006 to get back in terms of GDP per person to where we had been in 1981. And that's not something we want to risk happening again. But of course, it could occur. And next, the growth rate is about 2.6%, which is the current rate of population growth. The National Development Plan has urged that we commit 30% of the country's GDP to fixed investments every year to be spent on economic infrastructure such as Eskom and the ports, social infrastructure such as clinics and schools. The actual rate is 20% of GDP in 2014. And the further question is how we finance this kind of investment. When we look at our gross domestic savings as a percentage of GDP, they make up only 15%, far less than at the ratio in China, which I think is about 50%, and where China obviously has a great deal of its own money to do fixed investment. So that is not in that position. If we have to move from 15% to 30%, we have to bring in the savings of foreigners. We can't rely on our own domestic savings. We just have to get foreigners to invest in the country. Our current account deficit is minus 5.4% of GDP in 2014, so we also need foreign investment to come in to help us to continue financing our imports. Our budget deficit is projected at minus 4% of GDP this year. Our interest bill at $132 billion in this financial year, assuming that we get the revenue that the finance minister budgeted for, but may not in fact be forthcoming. It's projected to rise to $158 billion in 2017-18. That's more than we currently spend on housing and community amenities, as much as we currently spend on health. We simply cannot have the state level endlessly rising in this way, and to stop it doing that, we need to have more investment and more growth. As regards foreign direct investment into South Africa in the first quarter of 2015, it in fact turned negative. We saw an overall outflow of some $22 billion. And though the portfolio inflow was positive at $39 billion, that kind of investment is very fickle. The cumulative value of FDI in South Africa now stands at some $1,600 billion, and 85% of that total has come from the West, particularly from the UK, Europe, and the US. The cumulative value of indirect investment, mainly the purchase of equities and bonds, is now $2,700 billion. And some 90% of that total has come from the West. By contrast, FDI from China is now valued at $57 billion, which is less than 4% of the total, and indirect investment from China is $15 billion, or 0.5%, and investment from Russia is even less. So if we are hoping that we can alienate Western investors but still bring in a great deal of investment from China and Russia, I think we need to be very careful about the assumptions that may underpin such thoughts. If we look at where some of our key investments have come from, value of UK investment, both direct and indirect, now $1,650 billion in total, the Netherlands and Germany $410 in total, that means that cumulatively those countries have put investment into South Africa, which is now valued at more than $2,000 billion, I think you're pardon. And yet we terminated the the bilateral investment treaties that we used to have with these countries. And that must be a major deterrent to fresh FDI, to FDI in the future, because it will undermine investor confidence that agreements that were entered into and were expected to continue at no punishment. Firstly, will the flawed provisions of the investment bill, and in particular, I'm afraid the false claim being made by the DPI that the bill codifies the standard clauses in the bilateral investment treaties when that simply is not the case. The fact that the claim is not true must also be a cause for concern. So, my belief is that we need a new bill that is constitutional, that is sufficiently clear and certain, that is adopted with adequate time for consultation, that is very much in line with what the bilateral investment treaty says, and perhaps also with the SADC protocol, which intends to be, and which helps the country to counter many other investment barriers. Because apart from our bad policies, we also have the most fractious labor relations in the world, the fourth worst education system in the world, major problems of power and with our courts, low levels of productivity and competitiveness. We have a bottom policy gap, many barriers to investment that we need urgently to overcome, and we should not at the same time be making the investment climate worse for the policies which we adopt, because those we can have an immediate impact on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jeffries. And also I note that you do make certain proposals here. Thank you very much. That's appreciated. Members, let's look at yourselves then. Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Hill Lewis, in that order, please, so far.
Chair, first a question of clarity to you. My understanding of parliamentary procedure is that once a bill is tabled by the executive, the bill becomes the property per se of the legislature, and then it cannot be withdrawn by the executive. Am I correct in that interpretation?
We had this issue coming up with one or two other bills, and that was the case. And I remember in particular when you had to re-tag or something, and the minister chose rather to just to get which one it was, to have two bills. One had dealt with the admin section and one which dealt with the other substantive issues. And of course, once that was explained to the committee, there was no real problem in getting that. But this bill is now in Parliament, okay? It remains, if you like, the prerogative of Parliament itself. But Parliament then, through its committee members, may take a position that it proposes to the House that this bill is rejected. But, you know, but what we have done here for the last 5 or 6 years, we have redrafted, and I'm thinking you've been aware of that through your colleagues, I think in particular of C, I think of the IP, which went through massive redrafts right here in the committee itself. And I think you are aware of that situation. But no, Parliament is here now. It's not with the executive. Thank you.
Yes, no, thanks. That was my understanding as well. To Ms. Henry. What that would mean is that the executive is not able to withdraw the bill any longer, and so the two options available to this committee are either to substantially rewrite the bill in committee phase, or, as the chairperson said, to recommend that the bill not be considered by the House at large. Then on to your presentation. I think your presentation is very, very clear, and you've made some explicit recommendations, which I appreciate. I will ask you the question. I am certain that the IRR must consult to several major companies in South Africa, many of whom must be significant investors. Can I ask you what your impression of the impact of the bill will be on investment in South Africa should it be passed in its current form? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Chairperson. At the end of the presentation, you said that we need a bill that is constitutional and help counters many other investment barriers. Do you imply that the bill is unconstitutional then, in its current format? And if it is, could you identify what those constitutional problems with the bill may be. As there's also a lot of commentators saying that the bill is constitutional, and you may be referring to the point that it may be unconstitutional, and what are those constitutional problems. I just want to pick up something that I had mentioned the last time we lost the issue of arbitration. I'd like to get your point of view on it. That if government is the subject of the arbitration or the request for international arbitration, and let's say that the issue is around implementation of the expropriation bill, do you think that government would be prepared to subject itself to international arbitration where its laws and legislation would then be scrutinized in a state-to-state basis, and for a state where that investor resided to turn around and say, well, of course, that's something like the expropriation bill is not acceptable, therefore, you know, we would want to find in favor of the investor. Now, the last time I asked that question to the DTI, I had a very vague, if not unwilling, willingness to deal with that question. And I still don't think that we have a clear understanding how that would work if government is in fact itself the subject of a request to arbitration. My personal opinion is that government can turn around and of course protect itself. It wouldn't want to open itself up to international scrutiny, specifically on problem legislation like the expropriation bill. Thank you.
Legal matters surrounding withdrawals of bills, etc., by whom, etc. I'm glad we've had the experience of a bill of that nature, as it were, coming before the committee, and we have that experience of what would happen. So I am pleased we've had that, and we haven't got the new rules yet, so of course we abide by the rules currently governing the House. But Honourable Hill, as someone had interrupted me, I didn't hear your last question, so I wouldn't know when it would be answered. So I'd appreciate it if you would repeat it, please. Oh, I thought it was yourself. Or Matthias.
Sorry, Matthias. All right. My question to Ms. Jeffries, or Dr. Jeffries, was if government was itself the subject of a request for arbitration, i.e. that the investor wanted state-to-state resolution. Sorry, Jay, I'm wanting to repeat it. You're listening. Okay, all right. And then the investor wanted a state-to-state resolution or arbitration because, say, the expropriation bill had been applied to them. Would the government then be willing to, A, grant that international arbitration if its own laws are subject of that request for arbitration, and B, how would that work if a country where that investor resides is now starting to, you know, review South Africa's laws into how they're being implemented? And you'll recall the last time that I asked that question, it was a very vague, if not unwillingness, to answer that question. And I think the word was, we can't deal with that now. So
eventually pressed for an answer, and I got through a very vague answer. I'm now asking Ms. Jeffries how she sees that particular process working if government is in fact resolved the subject of arbitration.
Now, I want to thank you very much for repeating that, because it was an important point. Right. Are there any other questions or comments? No? Say yourself, yes.
I asked one general question, but I had a specific question. Thanks, again, Ms. Jeffries. You mentioned here your problems with the expropriation bill of 2015, and but what you added in your presentation sounded like your problem was with the definition of what constitutes expropriation and indeed what can be expropriated. And I wonder whether you would just repeat those succinctly for me. Then, secondly, you have raised a concern about the definition of investments. Now, if you look at the text of the bill, it does actually include in the definition all actions of economic value. Now, I would argue, you may differ with me on this, but I would argue that intellectual property is an asset of economic value, and in fact, in many businesses, core assets of economic value to the conduct of that business. So I want to just get your view on whether you think that any asset of economic value provides the kind of coverage you would like. Yes, those are the two. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just would appreciate a little clarity here on what is head of the necessary changes, all right, to investment itself. TB. In the middle bullet here, prohibit direct and indirect expropriation except where a court, in cases of a dispute, has confirmed constitutional validity of the proposal. Are you implying that the onus would be on the state then? Could you just clarify what it is you're getting to there, because that's an important point. The other is with respect to the third bullet, on the same page, provide compensation based on market value, less discount factors, which of course is there in the Constitution, plus the damages. Now, I was just grappling with the size of the bit in the Constitution here. I was familiar with these three factors, or the four, as you call it, because it's A, B, C, D, but one of them is market value, and E. If you could just refer me to section in the Constitution referring to plus damages, because I understood plus damages to be a court director and within the authority of the court itself rather than the Constitution for damages. But you may be referring to damage in relation to the expropriation per se. So if that could be clarified in that respect. I was also quite interested in this issue, which is coming up quite a bit in the proposals today and the presentations on fair and equitable, and on the some of the points being made here about just compensation and so on, and trying to get a comparative international recession of how our countries had operated on this. One has exhausted that, we'll certainly ask the churches to do that. But it would appear, certainly, with respect to the provisions in the United States in relation to this, that there is a reference to just and a reference to the Fifth Amendment in that case, but that it should also include softer measures. Softer measures meaning, yes, all of them technically, no problem at all. However, especially when it's to do with public interest and what they call welfare. However, on the softer issues, it advises an element of consultation, and the softer issues referred to for railways going through your area or whatever, you should consult folks on their attitude to relocating, as it were, which would perhaps be implied when the land was taken or expropriated. So you could perhaps just clarify that, and I've seen this before. It's quite useful when you comment on a bill of this nature. It's clear that you're not only commenting on it in relation to Constitution, but you're also looking at how other legislation and jurisdictions have dealt with this particular issue, and that's quite helpful to us. So if you would go ahead on that. Thank you. Dr. Jeffries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To start, I think, at the beginning, I appreciate the clarification that the bill cannot be withdrawn at this point. I would urge that unless very substantial changes can be made in the clause by clause deliberation, that this committee should recommend that bill should be rejected in its entirety so that more thought can be given and more opportunity can be provided for a more appropriate measure that will truly promote and protect foreign investment in this country. And I do, as I said, also have a concern about the very shortness of the time that's been allowed for public consultation, which I think has made it very difficult for people to comment and for all the issues to be ventilated properly. Then you asked what are the impacts of the bill on investors for whom the IRR has contact. We are bringing up a very great concern about particularly foreign investors who have to make the decision now as to whether they are going to put more money in the country. And they come to us today, it seems an unwise and an unsafe thing to do. And is there any reassurance we can give them that the bills that they're looking at are actually not really going to mean what they say or couldn't be applied in a way that might be damaging to them in the future? And it's very difficult, of course, to give that reassurance. Much as a South African, it breaks my heart to think that people may not invest in this country out of these kinds of concerns. They also deserve that as a frank answer. And from the questions that are asked, the number of people are asked them, and the number of people who are looking to take their investment out of South Africa into Africa or elsewhere, it's very clear that the economy faces a great number of risks from the other barriers to investment that I mentioned, such as ESCOM, which is a big one, but also from the policy environment. And the policy is something that Parliament has control over, or the ruling party can easily and quickly move to change. And that's why I think it's so important that we should certainly not keep on adding to the policy barriers. Then I was asked to elaborate on why the bill is unconstitutional. And it comes very much from the fact that we have in Section 2 of the Constitution a commitment to the supremacy of the Constitution and of the rule of law. And it is absolutely fundamental to the rule of law that rules must be clear and certain. They must not lend themselves to discretionary application. They must not be vague and difficult to interpret so that people do not know exactly what they mean or how they might be applied. And we have in the investment bill a number of important provisions which go against that. I think particularly in the description of equal treatment and when foreign investors might merit, that they will be entitled to the same treatment as South Africans in like circumstances. The clause dealing with like circumstances, the criteria that are laid out for determining that are extraordinarily broad, extraordinarily vague. I don't think they begin to meet the criteria of the rule of law. And that is an essential part of the bill. That is saying when foreign investors will have the same benefits as domestic ones. The other critical issue highlighted also in the interim presentation is this provision that says that foreign investors, the level of security that is provided to them will also depend on the state's available resources and capacity. Now, what is the level of security? Presumably, it touches on compensation, but we're not altogether sure. And to have your rights dependent on the state's available resources and capacity, well, we can see it's a hugely vague criterion. It has no real content, and it means that investors do not know what position they are likely to be in under the bill. And that is also contrary to the certainty required by the rule of law. I also think that the mere fact that you need the government's consent to whether there's a dispute before it can be referred to the courts, introduces an unacceptable level of uncertainty as to your rights. That you need the government's consent in one of those international arbitrations also introduces an unacceptable level of uncertainty on rights. And these sorts of aspects of the bill are not in keeping with our rule of law obligation. In terms of the government would give consent if a dispute arose and Investor had motivated his own government to approach our government, which is what would have to happen, to reach international arbitration. There is, of course, no guarantee that the government would give its consent. So there is no right to international arbitration at all, not when it depends on something as negative as the government's consent. And I think you're 100% right to believe that the government would be reluctant to give that consent. It's gone to great lengths to avoid the right to international arbitration which currently pertains in many of the bilateral investment treaties. Under those treaties, it has a commitment to go to international arbitration, but many of those treaties have now come to an end. And the wording of the bill is not sufficient to oblige it to go to international arbitration, and I think it is unlikely to do so. I was also asked to elaborate on the problems with the expropriation bill. I have argued very strongly in the past that the current wording of the bill prevents the courts from looking even at the validity of an expropriation. I am told that that wording is going to be changed, which is important. It's nevertheless, the whole structure of the bill is such. If that change is made, it doesn't solve the deeper problem. Section 25 lays out various requirements for a valid expropriation. It must not be arbitrary or irrational. It must be for public purposes or in the public interest. And the Constitution defines the public interest as meeting the nation's commitment to bountiful and a more equitable allocation of natural resources. But the bill tries to expand the definition of public interest to redress for any related kinds of racial hardship and harm in part, which is a different thing. It's expanding the scope of public interest from what was agreed in the constitutional negotiations from the constitutional text to something that is completely open-ended, which is problematic too. But critically, it's the procedure. So there has to be an initial basis of negotiation. They come along, and this is an example which really could apply. For example, two people living on the outskirts of Pinetown in land under customary tenure, they have plots which they own in a customary way. And the municipality might want that land for housing. It can go and negotiate with them and say, they're going to offer you 70% of what we think the market value of your homes on these plots is. If they don't accept, then the municipality can conduct inspections, at the end of which it can serve a notice of expropriation on all those households, and under that notice, ownership will pass to the state automatically by operation of law, possibly on the very next day. And the right to possess the property will pass automatically by operation of law very soon thereafter, perhaps on the 30th. And those people will have the right to compensation at 70% market value, which is unlikely to allow them to be able to buy an appropriate home anywhere else. They will also be deemed to have accepted that amount if they don't sue for more within 60 days. A company that I've spoken to has said 60 days is an incredibly short time in which to marshal all your information and find a representative and get court. Most people would not have, in practice, the possibility of going to court at all. Which means, in practice, all the protections in Section 25 will mean nothing to the people who are subject to expropriation, whether they're companies or individuals. Whereas the ordinary principle of constitutional interpretation is that where you have a right, the onus is on the state to show that that right has been upheld. And the time when a state should do it is before it acts to the detriment of the individual or the company. So if these preliminary negotiations start the dispute about the validity of the expropriation or the amount of compensation, it should be incumbent on the expropriating authority to obtain an order of court saying, which will only be granted if the court is satisfied that it's not irrational. This is truly in the public interest as defined in the Constitution. And the compensation is truly just and equitable. It rarely strikes an equitable balance between the interests of society and land reform and the equitable allocation of natural resources and the interests of the expropriated owner. And we can't just shortchange that process. If we do, we mean that Section 25 has no real practical content. And this will come out of the current Expropriation Act of 1975, which was adopted before we had a Bill of Rights and a Constitution, where we had no doctrine of judicial review, when Parliament was sovereign and would do anything it liked. But now what we do have judicial review, and we have a Bill of Rights that's supposed to protect people. We must make sure that our legislation gives the opportunity to draw practical benefit from that protection.
Dr. Jeffries, I am going to ask you to conclude, because we have been generous with your time, as you will see.
Thank you. This asked about the, I have answered the question about going for full choice expropriation as well. The damages,
yes.
The Constitution says that on expropriation, damages should be based on market value and all other relevant factors, including the four discount factors. In other words, the discount factors are not exclusive of the factors that can be taken into account. And in legislation, it is possible for the legislature to say, we would like direct damages for losses flowing from expropriation to be taken into account as well, because that would fit the words in the Constitution which they include.
Now what I'm going to do is ask you to come back in writing on the rest. We also want to see, we don't have with us here today the state law advisor. We have a researcher from that unit. And I wouldn't ask the researcher and just put it on the spot to comment here. And you raised some very pertinent points. I'm not state law advisor. And I would like to benefit from that information and advice. And I think the committee would. So we will certainly keep you abreast of that opinion as soon as we get it. If we can get it today, well and good. But for the rest, if you would come back to us in writing, there is a question that Honourable MacPherson will put on the table for that also to be responded to in writing. Can you please put it on the table, Honourable MacPherson?
Sure. I come from a province where 60% of the land is under Ingunyama Trust land, under tribal ownership. There are a number of international investors that have factories, offices on that land, which means they don't own the land. What happens then if there is a claim for expropriation in the national interest for that land? The government doesn't deal with the people who own the business. They deal with the tribal owners of that land. And the first time that they would actually even get to know about this, when someone would knock on their door saying, when are you moving out? And I would just like you to please answer, how does expropriation deal with the issue of investments on a communal land? Thank you.
Right, if you could come back to us in writing on that, and you're welcome to do so on any other point you feel you would like to add to, which you didn't have sufficient time to address. Because we are going to take a tea break, we will start sharp 11:45. Thank you. With Barbara. just making an inquiry. I'm not an authority on uniforms, so I wouldn't like to say anything at this point other than you're wearing uniforms and it's a green beret. So I'm just sending someone up to get the actual unit that you are and the work you do, so that we can acknowledge your presence. And we're going to get back in 3 minutes, just 3 minutes, to the work before us, which is trade and industry, and we're dealing with a very important piece of legislation, promotion and protection of investment. So just wait a moment. Thank you very much. We've actually got a delegation, a very large delegation from the South African Defence Force, the School of Logistics and Training. Certainly two very critical and strategic issues facing any country. And certainly we rather pleased that the Defence Force takes the training as seriously as it does its logistics. Thank you very much. And we hope you enjoy your visit to Parliament. Thank you. Now we have before us BASA, I think it is, right in front of us. We see a number of people we know again, Mr. Cash Kuvadia, the Managing Director. I think like me, you're becoming part of the furniture where you are. Right, never mind. Let's have your comments on this bill. You're from the Banking Association of South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I assure you I want to retire at the end of next year. Thank you again for the opportunity to present before you. And I'm not going to go through the first slide. I think we've been before this committee long enough to for the committee to know who BASA is. Let me, just before I go into the presentation as such, and I'll be fairly quick. Just to make a couple of initial comments that we've looked at this bill within the context of challenges that we have as a country. We are all saying that we need economic growth. We are all saying that we need inclusive economic growth. For that to happen, one of the critical factors is for foreign investment. For foreign investment to happen, we have to create the climate for investors to invest in. And we need to appreciate that we have serious competitors for that investment, and we don't need to look too far. They just cross our borders on the rest of the continent. We also looked at this within the context of the ongoing AGOA discussions and some of the comments that have been coming, particularly from the U.S. And AGOA gives us approximately 21 billion rand per year value of access to the U.S. markets. So we've sort of looked at it from that point of view to say that it is critical for us to ensure that we get foreign investment, particularly foreign direct investment, not just through the stock exchange, but real investment that creates jobs. And that this bill needs to be looked at within that context. So I read the sort of tail end of Dr. Jeffers' input, and in a number of areas in our input, we're talking about trying to align this bill to the bilateral investment treaties. Now, if this is supposed to be a codification of those treaties, then we should try to align it as attentively as possible to those treaties. The input is going to be looking at a number of definitional issues, which I won't dwell on for too long. Then we're looking at four areas. One is security of investments. Two is protection of property. Three is transfer of funds by the foreign investor. And the fourth one is just because of this. So those are going to be the key areas. Now, on definitions, we're saying that the definition of dispute itself is vague. And the recommendation we are making is that the previous definition, the previous draft version of the bill, which read as follows, a dispute means a claim by an investor that a government or republic has allegedly breached an investment protection guaranteed under the Act, and that investor has incurred loss or damage by reason of arriving out of that alleged breach. An alternative recommendation from us is that if the definition is not changed, that a set of criteria which clearly say what constitutes a dispute needs to be included in the law. Then the definition of enterprise. We are of the view that the definition currently in the book provides no guidance as to what constitutes a juristic person. Various pieces of legislation provide a different definition of a juristic person. And in Section A, the use of the word enterprise creates uncertainty in that the definition of enterprise includes a reference to both a natural and juristic person. Recommendation we like to make is that definition be included in the bill to define a juristic person, and that for the sake of consistency, that be aligned to the definition of juristic person as defined in the Companies Act. Then we put down there what it actually says. Subsection A of definition of enterprise, the word enterprise we believe should be substituted with the word entity. And the definition of the word entity as was included in the previous draft be included. And that definition said entity means any juristic person, whether incorporated or unincorporated. Then also just on definitions, just when we come to the investment portion of the bill, we believe the use of the word resources or economic value over a reasonable period of time is vague, in that it is uncertain as to what exactly constitutes resources all over a reasonable period of time. That's in subsection A, by the way. Subsection B, the use of the word shares, debenture, or other ownership instruments is also ambiguous, and that it does not align with existing legislation such as the Companies Act. and Section C, the use of the word holding a condition of merger creates ambiguity that does not align to the Companies Act and Competition Act, and is not clearly indicative as well as these obligations are imposed on domestically regulated entities. So our recommendation in that regard, subsection A, we believe needs to accurately describe what constitutes resources and over a reasonable period of time. Subsection B, the word share, debenture, or other ownership instruments should be replaced with the word securities as stated in the Companies Act. And Section C, clarity must be provided as to whether the obligation imposed in respect to holding, acquisition, or merger are obligatory for domestically regulated entities. Then, some of the substantive issues. Section A on security of investment. The section states, and I'm not going to read that, in our view, typical bilateral investment treaties provide for full protection for foreign investors as this increases investor confidence. And our recommendation is that the qualification providing security to investors, which is subject to available resources and capacity, is unclear and will result in interpretational issues. This section really should be redrafted in similar terms to the bilateral treaties. On Section 9, protection of property, one of the concerns that a foreign investor would have in our view is that its assets are confiscated, appropriate, or national. Typical bilateral investment treaties protect against this. In terms of the bill, Section 9 provides investors have the right to property in terms of Section 25 of the Constitution. Section 25 of the Constitution expressly provides for appropriate expropriation of property for public interest and public purpose, both of which are, in our view, not adequately defined. So that's the bilateral investment treaties provide for terms which are akin to market value. However, the Constitution provides a compensation which is just inequitable, and it is therefore unlikely that compensation will be provided at market value. Our recommendation is that the law should guarantee compensation at market value to investors in line with international protocols. Transfer of funds, Section 10, I'm reporting there. We believe that foreign investors would want reassurance that having invested in a foreign country, they would be entitled to repatriate the capital invested and the income arising from the investment. This section does not expressly provide for repatriation due to uncertain moral terminology, for instance, whether funds imply returns and what is the other legal legislation as quoted above. Our recommendation in this regard is that this section needs to be certain and unambiguous to encourage more foreign investment in South Africa, and it should be drafted similarly to the bilateral. On dispute resolution, Section 12.1 states what we quoted there, and our view is that having regard to the definition of dispute, the 6-month period as contemplated promotes uncertainty and government can determine whether or not there is a dispute and subsequently alert parties to the dispute. This does not, in our view, provide for a fair and independent process in the event government decides that there is no such dispute. Our recommendation is that 12.1 particularly that part of it provided that this dispute will only arise once the parties agree what is prescribed by law should be deleted. And Section 12.5 of dispute resolution, we believe that bilateral investment treaties usually grant an investor a right to bring an action against the host state in an international arbitration. So that the same point raised by the Institute of Race Relations. From a global economy perspective, there is a need to consider this point more closely and to amend the section to allow for international arbitration, provided that both parties consent without the need to exhaust all domestic remedies first. And we are suggesting that the section be amended to read that the government may consent to international arbitration in respect of investments covered by the Act without the need for the exhaustion of domestic remedies. Such arbitration will be conducted between the Republic and the home state. And those are our key points, Jefferson. And as I said in the beginning, that we're looking at this within the context of the imperative to actually draw foreign investment into our country. I think what's happened in the last few days, if one looks at Brazil, the downgrade there,
our economy is stagnant. We have a number of issues internally that we need to deal with. And I think sending hard messages that even give the perception that we are not a friendly environment for international investment, I think just exacerbates that. And the last thing we need is a further downgrade. So let me stop there, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cavaglio. Yes. I must say that what is appreciated is the way you've laid this up and is very precisely noted the sections you wish to get clarity on or that you disagree with, and then provide a recommendation. That does help us. Thank you very much. I just wanted to, just before I turn to the committee, take you back to your section 12.1, page 12, I suppose it is, your 12th slide, in which you say, raise one of the issues as about 6 months, etc., and then make the point that as it creates uncertainty or promotes uncertainty, as government can determine whether or not there is a dispute. All right? So, as you have referred to this, you may well know of areas where that have a different approach to this. Perhaps you could just refer to that if you know it off the top of your head before I turn to the committee.
Listen, I think what we're trying to say here is that an investor, when they invest, they want a degree of certainty. And that we cannot have a situation where a dispute is an issue is subject to dispute if only one party says that it's subject to dispute, be it government or be it anybody else. And that what we need is a process that we actually agree that there's a dispute. If both parties, in this case, I say the governments of the Republic and the investor, agree that there is a dispute, and then there is a clear process and a certain process to deal with that dispute. Off the top of my head, I can't think of other examples, but that's basically what we're trying to say.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cavaglio. For the public gallery, you're here before the, watching the proceedings of a portfolio committee on trade and industry, multi-party committee. We don't have all our members present. They're away on some medical leave, etc. But we have got members from the ANC, DA, and the Freedom Frontier with us this morning. And we are dealing with a piece of legislation, the promotion and protection of investment bill. What I'd like to do is to ask you to remain so that I can acknowledge you. Someone's doing a sprint up there to get your name and the organization you represent. Now, depending on how fast he runs, I imagine it will be another minute. Right. So let's turn to the members. Honorable McPherson. Can I see by show of hands, members? Right. Anyone else at this stage? No, do go ahead, Honorable McPherson.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Senator Cavaglio, for the presentation. I just want to agree with your points on arbitration, because the point of arbitration is to come to a settlement where two parties disagree. But how is that possible when one party has the ability to veto that option? So I think it goes back to Ms. Jeffrey's point that's not justice. That is justice by ransom, if you want to call it that. So I want to thank you for making that point. And something that I'm not too clear on is the point that you suggested to or alluded to, and I'm not sure if it is that, and that this legislation or the effects of that could lead to further downgrade in the South African economy. Could you comment on whether it is the effects of the legislation, itself, or both of them hand in hand? Thank you.
Right. Are there any other comments or questions on the bill? The passer? No. I do have one, but I'm also referring to the DG, Director General of Trade and Industry, Mr. Lionel October there, you know, the references to the company's act here on quite a few issues I see on page 7, subsection B and C, and again further on and on. Now, there's the aspect I'm concerned with here, is the statement you make, Ms. Cavaglio, that subsection B on page 7, the use of the words shares, debentures, or other ownership instruments creates ambiguity and then does not align with existing legislation such as the Companies Act. And you also make a few other references in that regard. So I am going to, if possible, ask the DG to comment. If he, you know, prefers to come back when DGI's term does come up, that would also be in order, as this has just come up out of the blue, as it were. So just one moment before you respond, Mr. Cavaglio. We've actually got the Old Age Club. I was thinking I'm going to start joining clubs like that. And from Mitchell's Plain, called Joy. Well, what a lovely name. It's a really inviting name like Joy. Almost encourages me to sign up. Thank you for coming, and I hope that you enjoy your visit. Thank you. So, over to yourself, Mr. Cavaglio.
Chairperson, thank you. On Mr. McPherson's question, I am not for one moment saying that this bill in particular and relating it to downgrades. I think that we need to be careful as a country that we don't have a pattern of regulation that begins to either say that is our intention or begins to create a perception that we are making it difficult for international investors to invest. So you know, we've been talking to, for instance, the Department of Land and Rural Development on their 50-50 issue, and we've made an alternative proposal that we believe can achieve a similar objective, but on the basis of more commercial and market-related methodologies. So if we start talking about things like expropriation, if we start talking about vagueness in processes. You know, business and investment is very fickle. They go where they make a return and they have the least hassle to actually invest. Now, we are not for one moment suggesting that you don't regulate. You regulate, focus on ethical practices, and ensure that the regulation is implemented properly. But I think that this board read with a number of other bills before Parliament currently send out a message that says that we are making it difficult for investment in the country. And without investment, we're not having growth. Without growth, we're not addressing some of the socioeconomic problems we have, and some of the rating agencies have actually pointed to those as a marker for them to actually look at us. So I'm looking at a pattern here, and this bill is part of that pattern. I don't know whether you want me to respond to the Companies Act. All we're saying there is that the Companies Act is a relatively, the amended Companies Act is a relatively new act. It's an important piece of legislation for business, and that we'd like to see any areas here that are not aligned to the Companies Act to be aligned to the Companies Act.
No, thank you very much. You know, I think the issues here for all of the presenters, which we are spelling out over and over again, is that this is a modern regulatory environment and we do need to deal effectively with investments. And we've said this repeatedly, yes, it's not only the promotion, there's also the protection, the openness, how is it facilitated, this investment. And thirdly, when all of that is done, we need to actually balance the obligations of investors as well as states. There needs to be a balance here of these obligations. And throughout, you know, the legislation, the robust legislation is the one that deals with this balance, how we balance it. And that's what it comes to in the end. But I'm just checking again with Mr. Cavaglio if there's anyone. But let me check. Yes, DG October. Thank you for coming in.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, thanks. Just a technical question that was referred to us. I just want to ask our legal expert, Mr. Kimuwe, that who fly back from Geneva. As you know, we have seconded him there, but we've asked him to come back because of the importance of this hearing. But let me just say that before any bill comes to you, we need to get clearance from the state law advisors. And the one thing that the state law advisor absolutely checks is consistency with the Constitution, consistency with the Bill of Rights, consistency with international obligations like the SADC Protocol, and consistency with domestic legislation. So there is complete alignment with the Companies Act, the SADC Protocol, the Constitution, and this. But in terms of the detail, I'll just ask Muslim to just elaborate on the Companies Act.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, honorable members. I think what the DG has said is quite correct. The state law advisors have essentially checked the compliance of the bill with various domestic and international norms, and they have essentially certified the bill before the bill was introduced into Parliament. However, in respect of the Companies Act, we've received several proposals in respect of the definition, and specifically in respect of shares, debentures, and other ownership instruments. We believe that it's important and imperative that we implement uniformity of decision, and that the bill is 100% aligned with existing legislation, including the Companies Act. So we believe that some of the submissions that have been made do have merit, and so we've looked into some of the areas, for instance, including reference to shares, debentures, and other ownership instruments, whether these would be replaced by securities as referred to in the Companies Act, or otherwise, whether or not certain terms that are used in the bill, such as enterprise and entity, is specifically aligned to what we find in the Companies Bill, or at least in the Companies Act. And so I think there is ample opportunity, and I think responsibility on our side to try and further integrate these particular concepts. So as a result, Madam Chair, we believe that these comments are welcome, and we have definitely included many of these proposals and substantive amendments that we could make to the current draft in conjunction with the state law advisors. So on this point, Madam Chair, I thank the intervention by Mr. Kavalia, and we believe that there is ample opportunity for us to further integrate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Thank you, DG, and thank you. Really, we appreciate just a minute. Okay. Certainly can't see two hands as I'm done, but just looking at the actual, I know it's Mr. De Gama, isn't it? But it must have been your first name, right? Okay. Let me look up again. We do have a member wanting perhaps to do a follow-up. Well, and then we have two new members. Right. Do your follow-up first, Honourable Macpherson, followed by Honourable Albert, and then Honourable Hill Lewis.
You know, I just want to say, you know, that I'm not sure that we, you know, should, you know, sit here and take comfort, you know, when we hear that the state law advisors, you know, look at this and certified and said, you know, it's good to go. And there's a number of pieces of legislation that have, you know, been passed by this parliament, passed by the state law advisor, and then been challenged in the constitutional court, being found to be unconstitutional. So, you know, I don't take comfort when, you know, you sit here and tell me that, you know, all is well because the state law advisor has highlighted those issues. What I'd like to know is, when are we going to see those amendments that have been taken into consideration? And I think those should be put on the table as quickly as possible so we know what we're dealing with. Because I wouldn't want us to get to the point where we get to the end of the public hearings and then they're only introduced us. I think they should be introduced to us, Chair, with your permission at the next opportunity that we meet. Thank you.
Just to clear that one up, did you not get the program? Well, if you check the program, you'll see you'll be getting that tomorrow. Well, it's in the emails because that's where I got mine, but thank you. Let us just go on to the Honourable Elvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to pose a question to the department.
actually also a question to the minister. He's not here, but perhaps the department can clarify this. I don't quite understand why we are presented with a bill that is really a bare bones piece of work that's supposed to replace complex and treaties that's filled with many rights. Clearly, there's less rights available in this bill as it is. And if you want to invite the world investor, why don't you take the best bilateral treaties that you have in existence and rework them together in a bill and present them to the world? Why give us this inferior piece of work? That's what I want to know, because I tell you, we're not going to get an investment, we're going to lose it.
Yes, thank you, Chair. There's two points of contradiction in what the DG and Mr. Dugamo just said. Firstly, if it is true that the State Board Advisor has thoroughly gone through the bill with fine tooth comb, then why is there this contradiction? There's two different definitions for what constitutes an investment, one here and one in the Companies Act. The Companies Act says, I'll read it to you, that it is shares, debentures, or other instruments, irrespective of their form or title, issued or authorized to be issued by a profit-making company. That's the company's assets. That's different to what this said. So the State Board Advisor to pick that one up.
If I have a dialogue,
point. So that's the first one. The second thing is that Mrs. Lubikita, in the previous presentation, agreed that the current bill, in its current form, is not in alignment with the static protocol on finance and investment, but that protocol is, in her words, being amended to bring it into alignment. So, you know, again, the State Board Advisor didn't pick that up either. And I think, related to that point, Chairperson, that if it is true that the bill as we have it before us is not in alignment with our international commitments, then we need to see the amendments that Ms. Lumi-Peter is talking about before us. Because we cannot consider a bill that's not in alignment with international obligations on the guarantee or the promise that we will bring those international obligations into alignment at some future point. We need to see those draft amendments now. So I'd like to ask for those documents to be tabled here, please.
Thank you. As I said, this will be made available to us tomorrow. We will get this engagement with DTI, and that's been a long-standing commitment that we've had, which is why we wanted some of the presentations which we are having today and those we had the other day, because it is important to get. And we will, of course, continue to engage. You'll get the first response, if you want to put it that way, and then there will be other issues that arise that we need to engage. And yes, I mean, we wouldn't have so many lawyers earning a living if everyone agreed on the Constitution. I mean, what was the point of having more than one constitutional lawyer? So anyway, yes, Honourable Kalako.
Thank you, sir. I was a bit worried that I accepted the contribution from the Family Association and its clear recommendations on areas which they are pursuing. I think the unfortunate thing was the department came in and now it's put us in another you know, a dimension of dealing with the issues. I would not actually come to engage the department this whole and take into consideration what happens. That is why we want people to come and participate and advise us so that we get those views. We are able to say, department, can you answer on this? Because differently from all the other presentations are saying there's no consistency with other pieces of legislation. This is what I think the department is going to get into detail with us, because we are also interested to get where are these inconsistencies. What the comparison with BITs and with the current bill for us, so that we are able to say you are not inconsistent with SADC or BRICS or all these other treaties which we are actually into a part of signing them. So to me, I think that let's allow that process and then deal with the department on this one at Halal. Because also if there are some amendments to the presentations which were made by the department
before we will welcome to have an interrogator those amendments which have been made.
Thank you very much, Honourable Colaco. It's over to yourselves, Mr. Kabadia. Thank you.
Chair, I don't think I need to respond to the interaction between members and the department. I have my say, unless there are any other questions. I thank you for the opportunity.
And, well, I think at this point we ourselves have done the engagement, but I think that you've been with us on many occasions and you would want to appreciate, I'm sure, in responses of the department, and I said that the other day, I think if you make a presentation, it's important if a representative from your organization can say the course, at least until you get the department's response, and not try and glean it from the media or if you're available to watch the parliamentary channel. It's always useful to get that firsthand. So thank you very much again, Mr. Kabadia, and once again for such a clear-cut presentation. At this point, we did indicate that we would invite the European Chamber of Commerce again because there was an element of perhaps confusion, and I'm sure all of that now is ironed out, nothing like a practice run. And so we invite Mr. Sakrashek to come forward and also to request, Mr. Sakrashek, if you can go through this but quite succinctly in half an hour, 30 minutes if possible, and that would be until 10 to 12, is it? 10 to 1. Thanks.
Thank you, Mrs. Jeffrey, and thanks for letting us engage a second time, perhaps more thoroughly, as this a chance also to answer some of the Q&As we had last time. We are new to this. As the EU Chamber of Commerce and Industry, we're grateful for the presence of the DG, who wasn't here last time, so I may be redundant in some of the things I'll repeat, but that's for everybody's information. The EU Chamber of Commerce is a newly established entity, or an MPC. We represent a sort of 2,000 companies in the SA, 77% of FDI. Dr. Jeffrey's figures, he had an opportunity to work those, so those cross-check. We represent 300,000 direct jobs in South Africa and some 150,000 indirect jobs. We play an important role in technology transfer.
Chairperson, I'm very sorry, Mr. Sakrashek, to interrupt there. Chair, I just looked through this, which is substantially exactly the same presentation that was made by Mr. Sakrashek last week. Can I just ask why is the presentation being repeated? What are the areas of confusion? And can those just be clarified directly? Because I don't think the committee needs to go through the entire presentation again.
So what we asked for here, if you recall, we weren't present at the last presentation of this chamber, was that it was confusing. We had I think it was 5 slides, if I'm not mistaken. And then we had a text of about 6 or 8 pages. And then we had reading part of the text and part of it. It wasn't clear exactly what was going on. So we ask for a very succinct approach. We don't want you reading through every slide at all. We want you to highlight the key issues, you see, so that we can read this ourselves. What are the critical issues that face your members? Because, you know, your members are the European Union Chamber of Commerce and Industry. That's a very important institution. It's a very important chamber. And we do want you to highlight these issues and then to indicate very clearly what it is that you would like us to interrogate further on. I think this is where it is. You represent one of our biggest trading partners. I think about 40% or something that trade, single trading partners. So of course it's important. But don't read that. I'm not just saying that. But our members are objecting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. Just to recap, this is a harmonized or concise form of the various elements that last time. We're not familiar with the presentation format, so we put everything to one as far as the observations are concerned, both general and specific. I'll just go straight to the recommendations per slide. You'll find that a lot of them are similar to what we already heard today. I think the essence of what we want to come across, what the message we want to convey today is that in the economic context that we are, yes, we are the FDIs, the famous guys who incur investment in South Africa and the region. And seen from the outside, South Africa is one of the investment destinations. The Europeans are heavily invested in the country. 1,800 companies is not small stuff, and some 2,000 billion, as Dr. Dukes mentioned earlier, in the last 20 years, is not insignificant at all. So 460 billion rand at worth of annual trade. We are South Africa's largest trading partner. In fact, there's a single block if you take all 28 member states. And we're gradually increasing barriers to trade. And the perception here is just the message that I'm conveying from 30-odd big captains of industry that I've consulted with in the last bunch of days, is that a sentiment of increasing barriers to trade is coming into place. And whether something commodities market, when we still be selling our commodities to the Far East and buying back substandard counterfeit and dangerous goods, the situation is detrimental both to SA investors, obviously, but also to SA industrialists, by and large. There are solutions for this. We highlight those. This is one of the topics that I think is very topical in this promotion bill. We make reference to the World Trade Organization, of which South Africa is a member of, and further specific reference to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, Article 7, where emphasis is placed on policy. We'd like a more level playing field in South Africa. We'd like a greater sentiment of attractiveness to carry on investing in the country, and certainly to avoid divesting or disinvesting, which at this present stage is not the case, but we're in a status quo in terms of decision-making for investors. Sonas, I won't repeat, we've gone through that extensively, but it certainly was about removing obstacles to investment and moving private sector confidence. The bill, we feel, does not do that. We're concerned about the cumulative of recent piece of legislation. It feels as though, again, I'm conveying a message, the goalposts are moving fairly regularly. And with the reported, I think our timing is also right to address the issue that we feel are essential, because in the current slowdown in China's economic growth, the devaluation of the currency affects all commodities markets and South Africa and the region in particular. So we're saying, careful, let's balance our trading partners. Keep in mind that we have a long-term investment strategy in SA as opposed to a short-term investment cycle, and that's driven by different priorities. China has its own set of priorities. We have a different set of priorities, and we have different stages in our cycles of investment. There are competitive destinations as an investment destination. We've heard it numerously from Banking Association, from the Relations Institute, Race Relations Institute. There is in the immediate vicinity, the Namibia, there's Botswana, and further on, and we've heard it from Amsterdam also earlier, there's a lot of similarities there. There's also Nigeria, there's also Kenya. So what we conveying is that we would like to see something that makes the bill more attractive to foreign investors. General broad observations, I'll fly through those section by section. I think I'll go straight per slide to our recommendation, which is at the bottom to the key of the slide, and then I'll conclude and give you the answers to last week's questions. So the bill does not provide for sufficient certainty or clarity regarding the substance and content of the domestic investment protection regime. We are in a structure where we carry on, in this bill, carry on attracting short-term investors. Again, I make a reference to Far East investors who are attracted by short gain, perhaps, or speculative investment as opposed to long-term investments. And we don't believe that is what is pursued by the bill. So I summarize this slide. The current bill sustains its discomfort following what I mentioned last week, the termination or certainly the expiration of some of the BITs. The bill does not create further comfort. The general observations, it's been touched on by almost everybody today, so I will not go there. The standard of treatment is clearly not sufficient to provide protection for the investors as it stands. Even though the bill seeks to provide adequate and equal protection, it does not do so. The vis-a-vis domestic investors and foreign investors is actually not terminated. So the bill substantially does not have enough promotion of investment aspects. There's nothing wrong with the bill in itself. Again, it's sovereign, and I'm certainly not a state law expert either, but it does not provide an interesting or an exciting factor to make South Africa a better investment destination as opposed to others. And certainly over the value treatment, I won't go there. We've spoken about it extensively. We need clear, transparent, and predictable investment rules. We've heard it earlier on, I think it was also from Basa or from Dr. Jeffries. Botswana, for example, provides a very set of clear rules for the mining investment. The definitions we've gone through, we agree with the comments that were given on previous definitions, particularly with regards to measure. So we propose the following definition to consider. This is where we're straight to our recommendation. It refers to binding governmental action directly affecting an investor's investment and includes laws, regulations, and administrative action. This is what we propose on the topic of measure. On the topic of investment, the definition is on the slide. We've all read it extensively. We propose the wording amendments contained in Appendix 1. This is at the very end. Sorry, this is the only exception to the rule. We have the view that the proposed rewording still leaves the government at least since hedge funds. This is, I think, the allusion there on investments at some point was caused by hedge funds, speculative investments in Asia. National treatment, there are two slides there. We request basically the two conclusions of the national treatment, which we've also spoken about essentially, is that for these reasons we propose the removal of the phrase subject to national legislation. And we also request the use of clearer, less open-ended, and vague language. I think that's common throughout what I've heard and what we've all heard today. Section 8, we suggest omitting this constraint as it detracts on the intended purpose of the bill, that is, provide assurance of clarity. Again, it does the same thing. No need to expand. For the specific change, however, the Republic must afford foreign investors and investments and returns equal level of security in general provided to other investors. We propose that the two words be reinserted into the bill as it was previously. Protection of property, we've gone at length. The spirit and the essence of the
country. Can you get over that again? What about the security of investment?
The section is overly broadly worded, so we suggest omitting the constraint, the wording subject to available resources and protection. We suggest that this is limited as it detracts from the intended purpose. The terms returns and equal have been deleted. In the present version, we propose that the two deleted words be inserted into the bill. Protection of property is a topic of unease to most existing investors, to all corporates, all future investors. We've had, as the EU Chamber platform, numerous new investors looking at South Africa as an investment destination. And the recurrent topic is, what about expropriation? What about Singapore as the best destination? What about Nigeria? What about Botswana? So we hear that from, I'm giving feedback as I hear it. So the general idea is that something must be clarified about property and expropriation. Again, the step law here will dictate, and so will the Constitution. But other specific comments are the value of compensation, fair and equitable, is not anywhere near market value. And that's brutally what I hear also from our investors. The right to regulate, I think we've also covered that last time. There's a need for inclusion of more precise language. The new version, in fact, has made a few exceptions and left certain things open-ended. But bottom line, we propose that these additional open-ended limitations be removed, again, and that the wording reverts to what was in the original version of the bill. Dispute resolution and regulations has been covered. I think Baza made a very clear statement in that respect. We accordingly propose a replacement of the current wording with wording from the original version. Again, we have been wording extensively back and forth on the bill. Subsection 1 does not include an investor from approaching in court, etc. Mediation, we've touched on. For mediation, we propose return again of the wording in the original bill, which reads as follows. The minister must make regulations on the processes and procedures relating to the settlement of disputes. Arbitration is status quo in terms of our comments last week. I won't expand. This is arbitration, so that's how we've gone through that extensively. We concur with the comments that have been made before us. Regulations. Even if mediation, if I can just look at the last section, even if mediation is not considered mandatory, the defining criteria for the appointment of the mediator of the rules, again, should not be optional. Rules and procedures must exist. We must have certainty and rules and procedures and criteria for appointment. Within any case, the standard ones that would apply every case, traditional arrangements, transitional arrangements. We understand that the bill is trying to cover some of the ground that was lost in the DFTs. We understand all that, and we've all for it to simplify the process by and large. But we are concerned with the ongoing DIDs that are still in existence, which seem to be favoring certain certain trading partners over EU investors. We all know, I mean, the general context was explained by large and broad brushstrokes. We know we have a budget deficit. We know we're exporting more than we should. We know we're importing for substandard goods than we should. So the value that takes place, I'm quoting His Excellency Minister Davies, and it's nothing new. But something needs to be done about reindustrialization or industrialization, further industrialization of the country. We need FDI. And that's... I'm getting to our conclusion slide just before our Q&A, so I'm still within my time frame. The EU business community, and I'm going to try to say this, I had a meeting yesterday with our excellence, the EU ambassador, Willem van der Veer. The EU chamber is a private sector initiative. We are not as perhaps diplomatic, or perhaps don't use as polished a language as our diplomats do, and that's their role. They have a very different function than we do. So we, on occasion, we can be a bit more blunt when we come to our phraseology. We are committed, we heavily invested in the country. We need further motivation to convince our members that it is a commodities market, there is a profit to be made. We've heard about the private sector is made up of profit-making entities who report back to shareholders, who report back to owners. So it certainly is an attitude of invest for a return on investment. And right now, South Africa is probably not one of the top of the list in terms of favorite destinations for FDI. So the contribution made in this submission are provided in light of our partnership, and we look forward to further engagements on these issues. Obviously, we remain at disposal. The Q&As, to go back to the last week's sessions, I think Honorable Lewis had a couple, and as well as Honorable Rousseau and some others, you'll find your questions in there, no doubt. We have challenged session 11, but we did not indicate the challenge as such. We indicated that we needed that the topics were, the questions were more open-ended. Specifically, notwithstanding to the contrary, there was in our submission applicable legislation which may include, if you were able to give that to us, so that this is the written reply. It states the purpose of the bill to balance between the government's right to regulate and the maintenance of an open and transparent environment for foreign investors. Our concern is that the section does not support such balance and that the bill could currently end up providing no protections for investors. The challenge is specifically around the inclusion of the three qualifications, which were not contained in the first version of the bill, so is there a sense there? These three qualifications make the exceptions in Section 11 more extensive, vague, open-ended, and consequently represent further limitations to the protection contained in the bill. The addition adds to the general unease with regards to overall value of protection contained in the bill as a whole. We would accordingly like to see the inclusion again, and repeating ourselves in the second section, we would like more precise language in the section as a whole. We further specifically proposing that the three phrases be removed and that the wording reverts to the one used in the original version of the bill. The next question, the bill does not as currently drafted equity to protect investors. What would be the impact on EU investors' perceptions? I think it was Honorable Lewis. The answer is based on a combination of anecdotal evidence, snap surveys, special interaction. This is basically meetings on the regulators with our members, and reports from individual companies and writing sometimes. Some investors are already recalibrating investments. I'm talking specifically as an example of a company in process automation, which was about to invest 50 million rand in a training facility in South Africa as headquarters in Germany. In Germany, there's lots of those. As I said, hold on until the bill passes, and then we'll reevaluate. So this recalibration, a lot of them are adopting a wait-and-see approach before investing or reinvesting, and considering, and this was quoted also by Anton, I think, this morning, other destinations in neighboring countries, the rest of the continent, in fact, Southeast Asia, as far as considering other destinations for the field. Next question, what impact do credit ratings have on investors? I think that was Mr. Honorable Rousseau. I'm just going to make that around the last time.
You must read.
All right, I'm good. I've got broader shoulders. Question three, the impact of ratings on investors. I think the question is the other way around. We haven't actually addressed the questions to our members, but it's more often than not the case that investors actually, by feeding back information upstream, will dictate the credit rating. So it goes the other way around. And right now, we have to address that specific question to our members. What rating would you give South Africa? We know what it is now. The bill does not, next question, question four, you said that the bill does not offer enough adequate treatment. Why? Point by point, because it again does not provide sufficient predictability to the investor committee. There's a number of substantive, interpretative and drafting aspects of the bill that cause the EU business community to be uncertain. The bill contains limitation. The bill says that its purpose to adequate and equal protection is all investors. However, the review process has created a differential system of protection for different categories of investors. I'm just reading that the sentiment is the same across what we said so far. Nothing different, nothing new. Next question was, are we a regional or South Africa focused chamber? There are a few EU chambers around the world. The EU Chamber of Commerce and Industry in South Africa is a new initiative. There are none other in Sub-Saharan Africa. There are some in the Far East, there are some in the US. I think its significance in itself is that it represents what means that there are a lot of European countries present. We have 12 bilateral chambers operating in SA, we have the Germans, the French, the Spanish, etc. We managed to federate those under one roof and to have one voice to interact with governments because we are very interested, we're keen, we're heavily invested, we want to interact and be constructive in our submissions and our comments. So I think very significant to the per se that there is a EU member in SA. We are certainly a national EU chamber for the time being, but as our name says, we have to encompass neighboring countries, and we will have points of presence in Zambia and Botswana and Mozambique and India in due time. Expand on what's understood to be that was the last question, or one of the last questions, I think it may have been. I think it was Honorable Kalakwa. Inclusive vote, we find that there's no actual universal agreed upon definition, but in the context of the State of the Nation addresses the last 2 years, the concept should reflect growth, and that's effectively what we have endeavored to do and have and are carrying on endeavoring to do. It effectively tackles job creation, reduces poverty, reduces inequality, contributes to transformation. It includes issues such as supply chain development and supply diversification. What I think this, and we can see this operating at ground level with all companies invested in, say, manufacturing or service or pharmaceuticals. The intent there is, has been, and carries on being so, is to build capacity, and it even goes further, to create companies which become contractors and eventually partners of the European companies. And that's just simply an economical reality. It makes more business sense that rather than have companies do everything themselves. So a lot of intent is outsourcing. We work hand in hand, very close with local foundations, not to mention the Sanduka Black Umbrellas, for example, which give us the market and sometimes even the scorecard points that we need in that respect. So there's a lot of outsourcing, supply chain development, supply diversification, fully intent on that, and that's not something that's specific to South Africa. I think that's the investment strategy and the business model of European companies worldwide. Skills transfer and transfer of technology. Leveling playing field, what we'd like to see there is part an answer, part a comment. Again, I go back to substandard goods. We've engaged and we've engaged robustly, in fact, with the NRCS on that topic. The NRCS is national regulator to compulsory specifications. We have an issue, and it comes up again on a regular basis, like a Loch Ness monster. We're bringing back too many substandard goods from what we can, again, we can point in the general direction of China, and it's not a China bashing exercise at all. We're also engaging with the China Chamber of Commerce, for example. China as a state, as a government, is also aware that it's got issues with its image. That being said, the market in the SA or in Southern Africa, we feel, is flooded with kind of goods that affect South African industrialists, which we're desperately trying to create as a platform, and it also affects our market, because ultimately, EU business, EU businesses are not welfare organizations. As I mentioned earlier on, the year for return on investment. And if we have unfair competition in the marketplace, we feel that it defeats the purpose of our long-term investment strategy quite clearly. And there are remedies and tools for that. SA is a member, again, of the World Trade Organization. There are methods around ring-fencing the market a little bit and creating a fairer and more competitive, certainly a more level playing field for manufacturing and industrials at large. We've also engaged with some of the unions on that topic, and it's quite clearly also something that's been around for 20 years. It was in the initial resolution of the Central Committee, actually 20 years ago. What are we doing about vetting imports before they get here? So, again, It's one of the issues where we have more room to provide inclusive growth and building capacity and opportunities if we are able to manufacture locally as opposed to importing. I think it almost goes without saying. European investors, I concluded that answer. We have a long-term view and a long-term perspective when it comes to FDI. While we strive for reliability and predictability in terms of investment frameworks, well written, investability in transformational changes and societal programs, I'll be almost my concluding comments on this. We are all, I think, aware of the fact that in some instances, and in particular in Europe, standards and norms and corporate social responsibility and respect for the environment by European companies are certainly of a very high standard and sometimes of a higher standard than the government itself in the country of origin. The regulatory framework, EC directives, for example, is just trying to follow what actually business develops, and we need a regulatory framework. Obviously, that transformation development is driven by the private sector, and this certainly has been proven to be the case for European companies. And of course, the balance of all that is in the following of the spirit of code of ethics and risk aversion. We've paid our school fees as European investors worldwide. We'd like to replicate the business model in SA and work in cooperation with South Africa and its market, as well as with its commodity market. Last question, I think we've indicated in various places that our bills requires different wording or redrafting. I'm not going to quote that, we've gone through it slide by slide. How do we want the bill to treat minority shareholders? I think that came also from, Mr. Lewis. We view the definitions of investment is not sufficiently acknowledged as a contribution of minority equity investments. I think, again, it goes back to speculative type investments, which SA is trying to protect itself from. We don't have a perfect answer. I don't think there is a perfect answer. But we would like to get clarity on the status protections on your end of the above kinds of investment. What is your position on that? Minority investors or speculative investors still often contribute to job creation and economic growth. I was mentioning earlier on the example of, and there's many of those, of a European company wanting to invest in a training center. The funds could be coming from a minority stakeholder of that business. How do we treat that? If they're not protected in this bill, where are they to be protected? Further to the point, as the sole factor being incorporated in SA, I think it goes back to the text of the bill, to see the physical presence. As mentioned in the memo, we would like to see substance of a form by large-scale financial investors provide relevant capital transfers into enterprises with a presence here and with reduced economic activity and create jobs in SA. That is our view that this should not be overtly excluded from the law, which is currently what it's looking at and feeling like a bit, as is the case right now. We believe that our proposed rewarding still needs the government at ease, and this is specific motion to hedge funds, would not be a reasonable period of time criteria. Have we consulted with our bilateral members? This is a product of a lengthy consultation with all our bilateral members, and between last week and this week we've done extensive massaging this submission in a more palatable format, if I may say so, for the committee. So we've discussed with the bilateral members, of course, but we've discussed and got feedback from about 200 companies, just a snapshot, European multinationals that view proposed entrance in the market, as well as the other bilateral chambers of commerce, and that's it for my submission to Mrs. Chair. I think I made it just on time.
Must have been a timekeeper in your youth, but here we are, right on time, thank you very much. And let me say that I have been somewhat critical of your previous presentation at the beginning of this, but I think what is very constructive is your questions are clearly identified and they are responded to. That is incredibly constructive. Thank you very much. But it's over to the members again. Right, I'm looking across there, Honourable Belvis, Honourable Hill Lewis. I don't know if that is a hand, Honourable Williams. No, it's not a hand, it's a body. Honourable Hill Lewis is our head. Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Elvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Just one question. I would just like to know from your point of view and your members' point of view, what would an ideal bill look like? Irrespective of the fact that you've made submissions on the current bill, and that is sort of like trying to pass something that's different, as far as I'm concerned. What would you regard as a proper bill? Would you like to see the current DITs taken and the base of those DITs reworded or reformulated into a bill so that there could be comfort for your members? The question actually is, what would give your members the greatest level of comfort so that Africa doesn't lose in basis? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much. Quick question of clarity. Does your chamber include the UK Chamber of Commerce? It does. Okay, thank you. And then the question on your presentation, could you just explain a little bit more about what you mean when you say that section on national treatment actually leaves you with the impression that you that foreign investors will receive less than national treatment? That didn't quite make sense to me. Thanks.
Honourable McPherson.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to ask a question on your views around the language that the American Chamber of Commerce have used when they said that this bill represents the final death knell for the South African economy, if it was to be passed. Do you, as a European Union, share that same view? And then secondly, are you aware of or in discussions with any of your members who have investments in this country whether they are preparing to relook at their investments or are aware of any investments that have already been withdrawn? And I think the American Chamber of Commerce cited four companies that have relocated to Kenya and have said that their members were almost not prepared to invest until they saw which way this was going. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. I just wanted to come to one here. It was 9 questions and 9 responses. You know, I was just making a remark to the content advisor that if we had only asked this question, question 6, and received the answer you have given here, we would be under the impression you had no problem with the legislation. So it's just as well you answered all 9. Thank you. Right. Over to yourself then. European Chamber.
Thank you. What would make the bill in itself, I think it's for us a bit the difficult answer because we've taken part in the building of this bill as it went gradually. We've gone back and forth. In our previous denomination, before we were called the EU Chamber, we were called EU SA Links. And we interacted with the DTI and OCS and quasi all the government departments to get some gut feel from the government and also quasi all of our members to get some gut feel as to where we're going. We're not putting the bill in itself in question. It's a sovereign document. We just try to, as a business would or as a foreign direct investor would, get the best for ourselves. And we're weary of, and I'm being quite frank about this because I think this is what we're here for candid exchange, and I'm trying to convey messages as wholesomely as possible without going into specific cases. We feel that we would have liked to see, and this is not a hint, we would have liked to see submissions from other business associations coming from BRICS countries, for example. We haven't heard from Russia, we haven't heard from India, we certainly haven't heard from China in terms of that bill. So we've been driving the process as collaborative partners with the South African government from the outset. So I can't put the bill in question. We just need to work with it in spirit of perhaps some of the good elements of the DITs, but we're going to work with it because we are here for the long term. And the thing I said lead up to that, we came on in this thing. We are almost in a system of inertia where we're going to burn our fingers if we don't work with the government on this. So there's no remolding of the bill. It's just that we want to work with it. We want to protect both our interests and in the process as an interest so we have a valuable investment destination. I hope that answers your question. Another one was a Lewis. Yes, Britain, in fact, is a member of our Chamber of Chambers, what we like to call it, as well as Germany, as well as Austria, as well as Belgium, as well as the Scandinavians, which have federated themselves into sub-associations, so we have Norway, Sweden, Denmark, as well as Spain, as well as Austria, and I will get rest of them, of course, I've forgotten some, but we certainly have 10 of the 12 bilateral chambers present and SA members on our board of directors, in fact, in this venture. the fact that European investors or European FDI would receive less preferential treatment, we still feel is the case. The competitive, and this is in at least four or five sectors of industry, the feedback that we got from, whether it's pharmaceutical, for example, and counterfeit goods, we feel counterfeit goods coming to treat medications such as TB or in fact the ARVs, antiretroviral drugs, coming in cheaply, and this is from a high profile European medication manufacturer, feels that whilst we are submitting ourselves to this whole process and undergoing the submissions with the governments and discussing this provision law and going forward with the other acts which will eventually have to be discussed, we feel that a lot of stuff is happening unbeknownst to us, and it's happening not in the public domain and behind the curtain or behind the scenes. So that's why we introduced the notion of feeling that we're worried about being unfairly treated in some respect, because there's a lot of stuff that's happening that we don't know about. Again, I go back to the lack of involvement here and from WERGO for the last 2 years of any of the other partners of South Africa in this process. Honourable Mr. McPherson, the death knell is not our, wouldn't be the terminology that we use. We hear, we've engaged thoroughly at length and in depth and certain issues, and probably much too long last time because we weren't aware of the format. There's a big weariness. There's a big question mark at the moment hanging on investment decisions, and I don't think that's positive, certainly. But it's not, you know, business is fickle, we've heard that also. Business will go to where the destinations provide the biggest rate of the biggest return on investment. Business will try to be tax efficient. I know the terminology tax avoidance is no longer of actuality, but business is like that. So again, I'm reporting a business attitude towards a potential investment destination. If it becomes too expensive, I think it goes down to the bottom line of one's balance sheet and in fact dividend payout to shareholders in Europe. If it becomes too expensive to do business here because of currency devaluation, because of forex losses, because of EE, because it's no longer interesting to do business here financially, then yes, business will move, and it's a brutal asset. If I'm aware of any companies currently withdrawing, no. But I have certainly been made aware of investments not being made or having been put on hold, specifically two training centers. One is a substantial one for a company involved in process automation in the automotive sector. It's not a manufacturer. They're putting their training center investment on hold because Forex would have had to come from overseas, and that's to build capacity and to bring some, if I real that kind of trade, you'll probably guess it is, but it's in the welding business or electronics and engineering. A second one is a smaller training center, typically the same thing, which has not held back on their investment for a training center until we have clarity on the extent of this bill. So I'll finish by concluding, if I may, if there are no further questions, that really it boils down to looking for a bigger, a better spirit or more incentive on this. And looking at it from the outside, we want South Africa to tell us, these guys come and stay and carry on and develop, and we're going to help do it. I think that's the bottom line. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, thank you very much, Stefan Sakoshek. Right, Chairman of the European Union of Chamber of Industry, South Africa, or Southern Africa. I said I'd go back to the question six, I've labeled them, we've got nine of them all together. When I analyse it would appear as if your members then support a bill that would promote sustainable development and inclusive growth, you know, when one looks at this. And would be useful if just in, you know, a couple of minutes, a minute or so, you could tell us, with respect to the statement I've just made, sustainable development, a promotion, a protection of investment bill seeking to promote sustainable development and inclusive growth. In that regard, if you can't reply fully now, I'm impressed by the way you were able to respond to the questions here. You could respond to it by email. What do you think in the bill before us does not support sustainable development and inclusive growth? Thank you.
Mrs. Chair, I think on that one we'll have to come back to you with comprehensive reply in writing for reasons of time and for reasons of input from our members, obviously.
Yes, a very democratic approach, thanks. Always advisable to consult one's members, as we do as well. I must say we appreciate that, and it's certainly, you're a fast learner. You know, we came very close to what it is we wanted from you. Thank you very much indeed for coming here. Right. And thank you to the presenters, all of you, those who have remained behind, or colleagues of those who did make the presentation. We hope that a certain synergy will develop and you'll see who it is you may be aligned with, how you may wish to change your view as the process unfolds. And then we turn to our members, and quite often we look at and see some cool group members here who never come to illness and are somehow immune. They must have very high immune systems, all I can say. But thank you very much for staying the course. I just want to deal with one matter that all members to remind them of. Is this on the bill itself, Honourable Hilders?
I have one that's on the bill and one on committee program. Just note, Chair, for the record, if Mr. Lumbi-Peter could please table the amendments that are being made to the standard protocol. And then for the Secretary, I think it would be very helpful to invite specifically, if they haven't yet indicated willingness or interest in attending, the Chinese and the Indian Chambers of Commerce. Because when the department made the presentation on investment to us just last week, that presentation made it clear that Chinese and Indian investment in South Africa is very significant. And so I think it would be useful to get their points of view as well. If indeed there are chambers of commerce from those countries, I presume there are, although I may be wrong. Those are the two issues on the bill.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hilders. We'll look at that, and thanks for the input there. To come back then to committee business, you'll all recall that three weeks ago, we took a decision on the basis of our earlier colloquiums and so on, that indeed it was important for the committee to go and do an oversight at plastics. And we were subsequently sent an invitation inviting the committee. Do you recall that, some of you? Right. And we said we must send a team of five at least across. This is a very important part of IPAM. It is also a sector or area that specifically requested of the committee that we look at some of the tariffs, etc., because they indicate that often when something is manufactured, there's quite a lot of plastic in it, yet that's not always recognized in the designations. I'm saying this looking at the Director General. So we welcome the opportunity to go and have a look at couple of these factories. Also, we heard how so many have closed down and how we are having to import such products. So it's part of the process, we felt, of encouraging the business community to come back into this area, as it does play a big role, significant role in value addition and beneficiation. So the DA said they would send one member at least. I'm not sure who that member is. Is it yourself, Honourable Hill Lewis? Thank you very much. And Honourable Albert, I know with all your commitments, you may not have been here, but certainly hope that as representing the, you know, all the smaller parties, as it were, that you would have come for that. It is a working day for us. We postponed the bill on that day. It's Friday. This Friday, it goes from 9:30 until 3:30. And it is a very, very important oversight visit, which we have the opportunity to go to. But if I put you on the spot, I apologize. I know, like me, you're running around the world or something. Right. Honourable Clark, can you tell us from the AMC? We had agreed that three would go now. I'm just looking at you two for that final name. Honourable Mkongi and Williams, but you know, the thing thing is, it is a Friday, but I do want to remind members, Fridays is very much a parliamentary voting day. Very much so. We haven't yet got to a four-day week. Right. Honourable Clarke?
No, Chair, I will confirm, I want to confirm with them that they will be there. But they were the original names also. So.
Thank you, Honourable Clarke. Now, you had a question or a program, yes. Could you please come in now?
Chairperson, as you know, I still have a private member's bill that is before this committee and which has not been finalised yet because, at your request, Chairperson, and at my agreement, it was referred to a subcommittee of this committee, which would also be tasked with dealing with the policy, the proposed policy on gambling by the Department of Trade and Industry. Now, that subcommittee was consisted of Mr. Bongi as the chairperson and myself. I've several times written to Mr. Bongi to say that I'm available to meet, but that subcommittee has not yet been convened a single time. And it is now some time after we made that agreement. I don't have the exact dates with me, but it is some time. Now, I made the agreement with the chairperson on, in good faith, accepting that the bill would be considered seriously alongside the policy by a subcommittee of this committee, and that that subcommittee would then come and report to the committee, and we'd have a proper and rigorous debate on its report. If that is not to be the case, chairperson, then I'd like to ask that the bill be brought back to the full committee, that we schedule the rest of the hearings on the bill, that we finish our engagements with the department on the bill, and that we consider the bill. But I'm not satisfied that the matter be delayed any further, that it drag on into 2016, when with the local government election approaching. There's no reason for the bill to be delayed any further, and I'd like to ask that we now either convene the subcommittee as a matter of urgency and proceed with our work, or bring the bill back to full committee urgently. Thank you very much.
Give me a minute, getting up the program here. Your point's right, and in fact, I appreciated your constructive response at the time. We also learned, I think, both under the impression from programming per se, that we would also have the policy before us at this point. And just a DG on this matter, as you know, at the time, a DDG is away, and Julie was here, and that was also communicated to her that we needed the policy here this year so that we could embark on that process. Because there has been this agreement, look, let's be practical and realistic. Let's get this policy. But I mean, having made that commitment to members of the committee, we also need the policy and need to know exactly when that is coming before us. We were under the impression it would be here at the end of September, and I haven't heard back yet from DG and Tuli. I wonder if you would like to comment or at least indicate to us of, when you could be giving us a date.
Honourable Chair, as you know, it has been out for comment, and we have, as you well know, received substantial comments on that. That will then be, there has been an engagement with the Minister on those submissions, and I think he has now directed that it goes to the Gambling Policy Council with the provinces, and he has requested that Ms. Zodwan Buli convene a gambling policy. So we are trying to get a date for that with the Gambling Council, and then we will have a position to give a clear report on. But I can emphasize that the Minister is very seriously engaged with this matter, and as you know, he's articulated his views on the matter. But now it's time to engage the provinces through the Policy Council.
Well, I'm really going to appeal to UGG to try and come back to us for some indication, because we can't keep a bill that we've already started to engage on hold, just without getting any indication within the same year as to what will happen. So I would hope that perhaps round about 22nd of September, then, that gives sufficient time, I believe, if you could let us, indicate to us, even if it is by an email, whereabouts. And we'll also, I see here the parliamentary liaison officer, is it yourself? If you would process that. But thank you very much, DG. I know that just put you on the spot, but we have been concerned, and we would have completed the process with that gambling bill, which is a private member's bill, but we all took a step back and said it's wait for the policy. So I would appeal to you, Honourable Hill Lewis, that I do believe we took the right decision, and I appreciated your practical and realistic recognition of that. But we also have to put pressure on the department to come back to us urgently. Now, you can see I've given them the 22nd because we're meeting on that day, so we can communicate the response and thereby take a decision. I will also raise it with the, and I know the whip is already going to follow this up, but we will raise it with Honourable Mkongi, because it is important that even before that is tabled, that you meet as a committee. So let me contact him, and perhaps you could leave me until Friday for that process. Thank you very much on that. And I'm glad you have raised it, because it becomes so old, we may need a review on it, and that always takes us back 2 hours or so. Members, there's just another issue here. With respect to tomorrow's meeting, we have the responses from GTI, and that's been on the table for a long time, because I believe the Minister may be here, and I say I believe, otherwise I do know you yourself will be here, DG, am I correct, with the DDG, but they were from the Peters. And deliberations on the protection. I want to re-emphasise for the presenters and for the committee, we've never railroaded anything through in this committee. We have no intention of starting now. We will deliberate, consider it, deliberate on what we have received. It's the first time we will be doing that, either seriously and in depth. The second thing is with respect to the rule in the committee with regard to who can take back a bill, who isn't allowed to, we didn't want to put the researcher from the State Law Advisors Department, because it isn't really her job to give us a response. That's not her function. But we will certainly approach the State Law Advisor on it. But I do speak from experience, having encountered this before, under a particular piece of legislation, when the Minister consulted us and we agreed that the bill in its current form be withdrawn and 2 bills be tabled instead. You may remember that, Honourable Elvis, where we then got a kind of admin type section of the bill, and then the other one, which would go via all the provinces in the usual way. So, but I do want to ensure that I haven't misled you, Honourable Kim Lewis, and I'll also confirm that tomorrow. And I think the other issue is on state law advisers. It's quite true that state law advisers have sometimes made mistakes. After all, I didn't expect them to be infallible. So, obviously, we're cognizant of that. But by and large, we go through the state law advisor, which generally means the bill is pretty sound constitutionally. And that's what we all do, and I think that's where we're working from. But we do not take it as an imprimatur. I hope I've made myself clear. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned until tomorrow in March, or is it V? V454. It's 8:30. 8:30, because we've got 2 items. We're also deliberating. Thank you.